good morning. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm a senior fellow here at the CSIS, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the CSIS Energy and National Security Program to this morning's event, Game Changers and Visionaries. I'm personally really excited about this event. It's the fifth in a series that we've been running this year called the Opportunity Tipping Point Series, where we look at the policies, programs, investments, and technologies that are designed to sort of hasten this transition to a low-carbon energy future. And this event in particular is sort of a long time coming. Usually what we do here at CSIS is focus on particular fuels types, particular technologies, particular policies and programs, and talk about how they're all sort of part of this patchwork of transformational changes that take a long time, that are need to be scaled, need to have adequate investment, need to be cultivated. And today's event kind of, we usually end up saying, well, these aren't game changers. They're not, things that will automatically, flip a switch and make a change. Well, today's event is actually trying to reverse that a little bit and actually look at the people and programs that are in fact designed to be game changers. Not saying that they are, necessarily, or that any of us are invested in any particular technology or strategy here, but that they do have the potential and that there are people out there who are looking to make this kind of transformational change. So today what we wanted to do was bring to you just sort of a sampling of some of the government policies, private sector activity, university activity, private sector activity, technologies, different strategies for those folks who are really looking at how do we make some sort of transformational change that gets at some of the major challenges that we face in terms of our energy and climate needs. So what we've done today is sort of put together a panel of these folks, but we are privileged to start off with a keynote address from Dr. Arun Majumdar. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Great, thank you. who is here from the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy from the Department of Energy, which he directs. ARPA-E was created in 2007 and patterned after the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and was explicitly designed to get at high-risk, high-reward technologies that deals explicitly with some of the energy and climate change challenges that the administration and Congress have identified as major challenges going forward. It was created in 2007, eventually got some funding in true congressional format, was sort of unfunded at the beginning, but was able to get some funding through the stimulus program. And I was actually privileged enough earlier this year to go to a conference that the ARPA-E office sponsored here in Washington, D.C., at the new what's it called? The Gaylord Convention Center. And it was really a fantastic event. And what it did was sort of highlighted all the excitement that is surrounding this office. It's an idea that came from a report rising above the gathering storm. And really there was a tremendous amount of bipartisan support, administration support, a true sort of star cast of characters there to support the endeavors of this office. But what I really found to be remarkable was, there's about 1,700 people attended, I think, and the energy that was there. There's a lot of people from sort of the technology venture capital world, people who really, were vested in these technological breakthroughs and different sort of strategies for how we produce and consume energy and how we look at energy systems going forward. It was really remarkable. And there was also a high level of excitement about Dr. Majumdar himself and the team he's put together at ARPA-E. And so we're really pleased to have him here today to talk to us a little bit about what the office is, what the role of government is and can be in this realm. And so we're really pleased to have his remarks today. He'll speak for about 20 minutes or so. Then we'll take some questions, and then we'll be followed by a panel, as I said, of sort of technology and visionary thinkers and people who've done a lot of thinking about transformational change or are actually vested in that change. And that panel will be moderated by one of the newest additions to our energy team here at CSIS, Jane Nakano, a former colleague of mine at the Department of Energy and really a true expert and really responsible for putting most of this conference together today. So without further ado, you've got his background, but very experienced in both the academic world and from the national laboratories. I want to invite Dr. Majumdar to come up and speak. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here. My thanks to all the folks in CSIS. I'm new to Washington, D.C. I'm from California, but I'm having a blast out here. This is a great town. It's different from California. I have to wear a tie out here, but, you know, that's okay. That's a small price to pay. Let me just say that the origins of ARPA-E goes back to 2005, 2006, when Senator Bingaman, Senator Alexander, requested the national academies to write a report called The Rising Above the Gathering Storm. And I'm going to come to that in a few minutes. But it was felt that in the energy sector, the United States, it's sort of going business as usual and not taking enough risks in trying out new ideas. And you'll never know whether things work or fail unless you actually try. And so they felt that a DARPA-like organization should be created. And if you go back to the history of DARPA, it goes to 1958, when DARPA was created in response to the launch of Sputnik. And it was felt at that time that the United States was losing its technological lead, and it got surprised by the Soviet Union. I believe we are in a Sputnik-like moment again. And there are three issues at stake out here: the energy security, greenhouse gas emissions, as well as U.S. technological lead. And these three issues are really at the core of our national security, economic security, and environmental security. Just to give you an example, one example of a Sputnik moment, here it is. This is the manufacturing volume of lithium-ion batteries. And as of 2009, this is pre-Recovery Act investments in batteries, the United States had 1%, a whopping 1% of the manufacturing volume of lithium-ion batteries. And it's ironic that last year's Fermi Award, which is the highest award of the Department of Energy, was given to Professor John Goodenough of UT Austin for inventing the lithium-ion battery. And frankly, it's just not good enough. It is staggering what this, and I can give you many more examples. You know, Bell Labs invented the modern solar cell. We have less than 10% of the market share in terms of manufacturing of solar cells. And you can go on and on. Frankly, we have not paid attention to energy. Energy was not in our sort of radar screen for at least 2 to 3 decades. And the last time we really paid attention to energy was in the 70s. So right now, there's a lot of reliving of the 70s. But frankly, we have to take a different angle because things have changed. Greenhouse gas emissions was not there at that time. So let me just identify some opportunities. I could talk about U.S. technological lead, energy security, greenhouse gas emission. I tell people that pick one, at least one, whatever suits you, and let's talk about it. Let me just give you where we are. Which path should we take globally? So this is on the vertical axis, CO2 emissions per capita, and the horizontal axis is GDP per capita, sort of related to the income level. And the dash red line at 5 tons of CO2 is the global average. So 5 times 6.5 billion people is the total global emissions of CO2, which is about 25 to 30 gigatons of CO2. United States has the highest GDP per capita, also has one of the highest. It's competing with Australia in terms of CO2 emissions per capita. And we know which direction United States ought to be really going. Well, that's clear. There's only one direction we should be going. But if you look at the left-hand bottom corner, you have really the growing economies of China, Brazil, India, Mexico, etc. And per capita, of course, they look good because the population is high. But their income levels are going up. And as we know, when the income level goes up, your energy consumption goes up, and your CO2 emissions generally go up. There are some exceptions to the rule. France, if you go nuclear, Well, the CO2 emissions don't go up as high. So which path will they take? Well, certainly this is the path is the business as usual, hopefully down later on in 20, 30 years, but this is business as usual. But the indications that we are seeing from around the world is that people are really willing to take the other path. And that is, frankly, because of multiple reasons. But people have realized that the nation that really focuses on clean energy generation use will lead the global economy of this century. This difference, both between the red and the green and the blue line, are really opportunities. And frankly, I would say these are business opportunities for the United States. So this is sort of the global perspective, and it is a global economy. And we need to grab this, because if we don't, someone else will. So this is the opportunity that we have today. And the next 20 years, and I'll come to that, the next 20 years, frankly, should be the most inventive time of our history. So the pace and scale of innovation that we really need today. So if you look at the last century and the game changes of the 20th century, you can go down the list. Early in the century was artificial fertilizers, the Haber-Bosch process of growing food, of fixing nitrogen. Most of us would not be here if it was not for this, because the population took an inflection point and grew four times, quadrupled in 100 years, which is great. It touched humanity like nothing else, but also created problems because of energy use now. So artificial fertilizers, probably the most important invention, discovery, innovation of the last century. And there's a lot written about it. Green Revolution, I would not be here if it was not for the Green Revolution. Polio vaccination, antibiotics, you can just go down this. And these are game changers in such a way that once you cross this curtain of nuclear or airplanes, antibiotics, then there's no looking back. It is a game changer. So that was 100 years. The place that we're in today and the opportunity that we have, as well as the challenge, suggest that if you imagine all these kinds of game changes happening in a span of 20 years, that is really what we need. And you can go down the list and say, what is that list? Well, let me just throw in my 2 cents worth. Solar electricity generation at a cost lower than that produced from fossil fuels. If you can get solar at $1 a watt, fully installed cost, it'll scale without subsidies. You don't need subsidies for it to scale, because it's at the same cost, almost at the same cost as coal and natural gas, etc. Real-time optimization, security, and storage for the grid with two-way dispatchable traffic on the grid. That would be really interesting. And the combination of the first two says that you could actually have distributed generation and people could make money out of selling energy that's produced in a distributed way. That does not exist today. Carbon capture utilization at a net cost that is lower than its market price. And I'll come to that again later on. And you can just go down this list. I don't know whether this is this is just my today's thinking. This is what it is. You could have many different angles to this. But to do that in the next 20 years is absolutely critical, to go after it. And to get to the final solution, or maybe not, maybe two or three solutions, you have to take about 50 or 60 shots at it. Otherwise, we'll never know which is the best one. And it has to be some competitive process inside the United States. So people say that, we are the best in the internet. We have Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft, etc. And Google is number one, Yahoo is number two, and so on and so forth. But then number one and number two in the world, not just in the United States. And that's because of some internal competition that we have created in a market-based economy. So to do this, of course, one of the approaches, there are multiple approaches. One of them is the creation of ARPA-E. And as was pointed out, it was authorized in America Competes Act in the previous administration, and it was appropriated through the Recovery Act, and we are now obligating that money, and FY11 is the first baseline budget that has been proposed. What is an ARPA-E project? What defines ARPA-E? clearly high impact on the ARPA-E mission areas, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, energy security, energy efficiency, and U.S. technological lead. Just picking up from the history of DARPA, that part is absolutely in the statute. Disruptive, innovative, technical approaches, and new learning curves. That is, if you're looking at lithium and batteries of today and want to improve it, there are other places in DOE to go. But if you want to be disruptive and looking at other kinds of batteries that could make today's batteries obsolete, that's the kind of technology that we are looking for. Strong impact on ARPA-E funding relative to the private sector. What we really want to do is to invest in technologies that are too risky for the private sector to invest in. And invest in portfolio. You want to get the next generation batteries? We'll invest in 5 different approaches. And let's see after 3 or 4 years what is best for business and let the private sector scale it then. That's our goal. And finally, best-in-class people and team. And this is very important, the human capital. To attract the U.S. intellectual horsepower to energy. Because frankly, we do not have enough people working in energy. And this is from my own experience at UC Berkeley. I was in charge of recruiting faculty across the whole campus, not just one department. And for 3 years, we could not recruit a faculty in the energy area. And this was going back about 4 or 5 years. Because there were not enough people in this area, because there are not enough funding and not enough PhDs in this area. So this is something now we're looking at, and I'm happy to report from the latest rounds of funding that some of the best minds who were not involved in energy, best minds looking at biology, members of the National Academy of Science, Howard Hughes medical investigators, were looking at medicine, now turning their attention to energy. The best computer scientists who were looking at IT, turning their attention to energy. This is probably the best thing that is happening. So this is really what we are looking for, and especially in the people, some younger people getting into energy is something which is very important. And so this is what ARPA-E is looking for. In the first round of funding, just a little report of that, this is before my time in ARPA-E, they were expecting about 400, 500 concept papers coming in. Almost 4,000 came in and actually broke down the DOE computer system. And we have a better computer system that we created now, and it's being exported to other parts of DOE. And eventually, there were thorough sets of reviews. Eventually, 37 projects got funded at an average of $4 million for a span of 3 years. Now, this was, again, before my time, but I'm so glad they did not fund 1,500 projects with 100K each, because that would have been absolutely diffuse, and we have seen that before. So this is for a startup company, and about 45 to 50% of the money went to small business. This is Series A, done. And they were trying to raise money, and the venture capital world was telling them, this is too risky for us right now. And that's the kind of stability that we could provide in taking some risks and getting it to the level that it then becomes marketable for the venture community. So just some ideas. And let me throw them at you, because this is what is, when I get to become a kid in a candy store, is to the ideas that are coming through. So this is a startup company called AgriVida, and it is involved in cellulosic biofuels. So the traditional approach to cellulosic biofuels is that to take agricultural waste, switchgrass or whatever, and to take that feedstock and separate out the cellulose from lignin and other stuff around. Take the cellulose and then throw a cocktail of enzymes, biological enzymes like cellulase, exocellulase, endocellulases, and others. Throw them so that this long polymer, which is cellulose, which is paper, can be broken down into small sugar molecules. And then you take the sugar molecules and feed them into bugs, which are programmed to produce gasoline directly, or ethanol for that matter, or butanol. The most expensive part out here is the enzymes. That has to be produced at scale and then thrown at it. What AgriVida is doing is taking a disruptive approach. They are taking this cocktail of enzymes, these proteins. They know what the gene sequence is, And they insert the gene sequence in the plant itself. So the plant is producing these enzymes at zero cost. But what they have done is borrowed a technology from medicine where they could block these enzymes. So these plants are growing. The enzymes that chew themselves from the inside are still growing, but they're blocked. Till you trigger from the outside with a little bit of heating, with some pH control, etc. And they get activated, and the plant then chews from the inside. Vernacular language, this is like putting the cow inside the plant. And we don't know whether this is going to work or not. I hope it really works out, because if it does, it is disruptive. Because the whole cost of producing this enzyme externally can be, is largely eliminated. So this is one example. Second example, this is from MIT, grid-level electricity storage. The biggest white space in the grid is storage. Right now, we're trying to get a smart grid. It'll be way smarter if you have a storage. I mean, I like to call the grid today, and I pardon my crass language out here, it's like the human body without the bladder. And what we're trying to do when we drink coffee, is to quickly find a bathroom. That's what we're doing today. And in the absence of bladder, that's probably true. But if someone now discovers a bladder, wouldn't that be a game changer? Yeah, a coffee break would have a different meaning then. But that's what it is. So this is a technology that is coming out that's being developed in MIT, which what they're doing is they're taking aluminum manufacturing, which needs a lot of current, hundreds of thousands of amps of current to electroplate aluminum from a molten salt, and they're trying to do that at both electrodes and use electricity to the storage of electricity through this, and the discharge part as well, which is very critical. And the key factor out here, again, coming to the cost, is that they think that they could do it at less than $100 a kilowatt hour. And this is very important, because at $100 a kilowatt hour, it'll scale not just in the United States, but globally. So what I'm trying to point out is the fact that, as opposed to DARPA, which is in looking at technologies for the defense sector, ARPA-E has to be a little different. We have to not only look at the technology, but the economics of it, because it has to be market-driven. And so that's the combination of technology and business that is very critical. Another example of perhaps the next generation wind turbines, which are way more efficient, and it looks like a jet engine because that's what it is. It's using the principles of a jet engine to increase the efficiency to be much higher. That's why we don't see propeller planes today. We see jet engines today. And there's very good reasons why that is so. I can go on and on, but I'm going to pause out here. As was mentioned, we had the ARPA-E Energy Innovation Summit. It was organized in a span of 2 months, and we were overwhelmed by the response of 1,700 attendees. And these were people not only from the tech community, but also from the investment community, from the policy folks, as well as Congress and White House, etc., the business community, large business, small business, etc. And this is perhaps what ARPA-E, or for that matter, DOE can do, is to act as a catalyst, is to really enable this many-body interactions and let them really find the deals for themselves. And what we have heard is that there were some really good deals that were made on the floor. What we did was we showcased not only the ARPA-E technologies, the things that we invested in, but we brought in the folks who we could not fund, but they're still pretty damn good. We just did not have the dollars. And we got them to showcase their technology, saying that if you want to showcase, if you can get investment from somewhere else, it'll take more than ARPA-E to change the ballgame. And it is really important to grow that family beyond just ARPA-E. And we are going to do this every year. In fact, there was a lot of suggestion from Congress to do some mini-summits around the country, which we are planning right now. So a few other examples of programs that we have just started and would be finding, the ideas that are coming through, is just absolutely fabulous. Batteries for transportation, the electrification of the transportation sector. Today, the batteries are too expensive, the range is too low, and the weight is too high, which comes down to the fact that the energy density of a battery of 150 watt-hour per kilogram is just too low. and the cost of $1,000 a kilowatt hour is too high. What we really need is batteries which are much cheaper, longer range. The energy density at the cell level needs to be at least 400 watt hour per kilogram, which is beyond today's lithium-ion battery. The theoretical limit of today's lithium-ion battery is less than that. And the cost, four times less, $250 a kilowatt hour, which is, you know, will then make it affordable for people to buy. It's not a Tesla anymore. It could be a sedan, which is $20,000 or so. New architects for manufacturing. The manufacturing in batteries has not changed for a long time, and perhaps their opportunities are there. And it need not be lithium-ion. We said, we don't care whether it's lithium or magnesium or unobtainium. We don't care. As long as you meet those targets. And, the Japanese government is investing, we find, that $60 million a year, and probably the private sector is investing more. So we have not invested, frankly, in this area in any focused way. What is coming out, and this was announced a few weeks ago, and David Danielson is a program director who is originally from MIT, from the venture capital world then, and now the first program director in ARPA-E. And this is his program. And we have a whole array, a portfolio of both manufacturing approaches as well as different architectures and materials for battery, whether it's magnesium ion or zinc air battery, which is reversible, rechargeable, lithium sulfur batteries, lithium air batteries, and there's some really innovative ideas about making ultracapacitors into volumetric approaches, which is like a battery. So this now is the portfolio that we look at. And eventually, after 3 years, if one or two of these is successful and then private investment comes in and scales, that'll be a success story. We'll see. Carbon capture. This is managed by Mark Hartney, who has a really illustrious background from Berkeley, DARPA, Lincoln Labs, Bell Labs, Flextech, etc. In looking at carbon capture, and today's approach of carbon capture is using amines. So you bubble your CO2 in amines, and the amines are then bound to the CO2. You separate them out, and then you go to heat the heck out of it to separate out the CO2. And the cost is about $80 a ton of CO2. And the price of CO2 in the market today, if you go to Europe, it's about $30 a ton of CO2. So if someone wants to start a business in CO2 capture, you start off with a loss of $50 a ton of CO2. That's a non-starter. So our goal is to see whether the alternate approaches, alternate to amines, where you could reduce the cost of capture and to below the price so that someone can start a business out of it and then scale. Here are some examples. I'll just focus on one, which is from GE, the phase-changing adsorbents. This is a liquid which has a molecule in it. You bubble CO2 in it, and that molecule turns out to be into a solid, and you can extract it out. This is a completely different approach from today. And you extract it out, then you heat it mildly, and the CO2 comes out. The second one is from University of Notre Dame, where you have a solid, you expose it to CO2, it turns into liquid. Amazing ideas. We never knew these existed before. And I won't go into the details of the others. But these are the kinds of ideas that are now coming out from some of the best minds. Joan Brenneke was a 2009 Lawrence awardee, some of the best minds in chemistry and chemical engineering, now focusing their efforts on energy. The electrofuels is another program which is managed by Eric Toon, where the idea is to use electricity, which is hard to store, hydrogen, which is also difficult to store, and we have a lot of hydrogen from natural gas, etc., and CO2, which is a greenhouse gas, and combine it to form gasoline, which we import 60%. This is like killing four birds with one stone. And what we are now, what is it, the green box, are new aspects, new organisms in biology which have never been used. Biofuels comes from photosynthesis. That is one pathway to fix carbon dioxide and make carbon-carbon bonds. There are three other pathways that we haven't even touched upon. And this is now trying to use other biological pathways. And there's some brilliant minds from, again, Howard Hughes investigators and National Academy of Science members in the biology field turning their attention to fuels. We are trying to grow our team now, organization. We have four teams, program team. We are trying to recruit some of the best and the brightest from the technical community to serve the nation for a few years and then go back and do their thing. And by statute, their time is limited, and they have to excel in what they do in that limited amount of time. And their goal is to provide some thought leadership, create some new programs, and hands-on program execution, to go there and visit what's going on in the lab and help them. Commercialization team, two jobs. One is to help ARPA-E teams to commercialize, to see what is the exit strategy for them from ARPA-E. They need to then be handed off to the private sector, and their goal is to work with the private sector, both industry and the investment community, to do so. And the other goal is to collect market data. We need to be data-driven and to collect data or market trends, not just in the United States, but globally, to help create programs accordingly. The operations team, I won't go into the details, and an outreach team to really explain to the public and all the stakeholders what we're trying to do and to get feedback from them. And, of course, this is a flat organization. They all report to me and the deputy director, and we're creating sort of a board of trustees that we can bounce our ideas off. And these are some of the thought leaders in this country. And no one so far has said no to this particular brain trust you're forming. ARPA-E I report directly to the secretary, but I coordinate very closely with Steve Koonin, who's the Undersecretary of Science, and Christina Johnson, Undersecretary for Energy. And all our programs are created in very close coordination with the other parts of DOE, so that even though we are supposed to be disruptive and different learning curves, we need to know what's going on in the other fields, and so that they could be some of the handoff strategies to the applied programs in the future. Managing expectation. A lot of people come and ask me, when is the equivalent of the internet coming from ARPA-E? And is it 2 years or 3 years? And if you know the history of the internet, it took about 15 or 20 years for it to really scale. In 1968, that's when it started. By 1970, how many people were there in internet? Probably 5 or 10 at the most. But it scaled at some point. So expectations should be, it's a function of time. So today we can show some success stories, some large number, oversubscription, let's put it that way, and some looking at targeted white spaces in investing. If you are to hit some home runs, the equivalent of the internet, if you may, in the energy field, it's going to take at least 10 plus years. Before that, we won't know whether it's truly a home run. And so if it is a home run, 10 plus years, we know what it looks like. Domestic global sales, avoided greenhouse gas emissions, reduced oil imports, moving the McKinsey curves, the IPCC projections. If you could do that, that's a home run. The question is, the most important question is, what happens now in the next 3 to 5 years? And all we can say is whether we can create the vectors that are pointing in the right direction. And we need 10 vectors to get a home run, to get a single home run. So all we can say is, are we attracting the best minds to the energy field? Is there follow-on investment to ARPA-E? Are there new companies being created? For every 10 companies, maybe one is successful. Are we initiating a new technology business ecosystem? Are we accelerating market entry? And you can go down this line. That's all we can really say in the next 3 to 5 years, so that the vectors are pointing in the right direction. Let's talk a little bit about strategy. I'm sure you have seen this, this is the Sankey diagram, or more colloquially called the spaghetti chart of the United States. On the left-hand side is the supply of energy. On the right-hand side is where the energy goes. In between is electricity generation, transmission, distribution. So if you look at it today and you ask the question, what is our mission? Mission is energy security, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, energy efficiency, and U.S. technological lead. Let's keep U.S. technological lead out of the way, because that goes across the board. And let's look at energy security. I think you all would agree the biggest problem in security is that we're importing a lot of petroleum from places that don't often like us. That is out here. If you could reduce that significantly, that's a security issue, energy independence. I think all would agree with that. But where is it going? It is going mostly to the transportation sector. So the question is now, if you look at it holistically, can we change the transportation sector so that it does not depend on the fuel? Well, what could it be? We have just found a lot of natural gas, shale gas, which is now developed or produced in the United States. Should that be one of the options that the United States has for the transportation sector. Today, we don't quite use that. In the rest of the world, other parts of the world, they do use natural gas for transportation. The range is lower. There are other problems, et cetera. And when you produce natural gas in this country, you create water problems, other things. But should that be one of the options? That's a question worth discussing. The other option is that arrow going down, I don't know if it clearly shows, is the electrification. Because if you look at where the electricity comes from, mostly it's coal, nuclear, natural gas. It's not from petroleum. And that's where the battery, et cetera, comes in. And of course, we need to increase the CAFE standards and do other things on reducing the consumption. But if you look at it holistically, if you want to reduce the petroleum consumption, you got to address the other sources of fuel where it comes from, whether it's electricity, electrification, or natural gas and others. Or create the fuels from other sources. This is rewiring the diagram. And this is where biomass comes in, but it frankly need not be only biomass. It could be electricity to fuels, etc., which is the electrofuels program. So either we substitute for petroleum by other means, or we provide alternates, options for the nation for fuels, for imported fuels. And clearly we need to decarbonize this part. There's no question about it. And the best way to decarbonize is at centralized plants and not in a distributed way. And that's where carbon capture and others come in. There's no question we need to amplify the renewables part, nuclear as well as the renewables part. But to amplify has to be done at cost, which is why I was saying if we can get to a cost solar PV at $1 a watt, that would be a good thing because it will scale without subsidies. You don't need policy to scale it. It's a business proposition then. Transmission distribution today is a one-way street. But could it be a two-way street where you could actually really sell energy and from point A to point B and then actually make money out of it? And that, of course, it needs to be way smarter than what it is today. People. This chart does not have people. This is probably the biggest white space I can think of. Most of the people that I have come across really don't know how much energy their home uses. I had to dig my PG&E bill to find out how much my home uses. But this is something that if you can get the awareness going, this is a big deal. And kids today, that's really my hope, the kids know more about megawatts than megawatts. And they often don't know the difference between megawatts and megajoules. And that is an education that we really need and I really have hope for the kids to educate their parents. How to scale. Scaling is the biggest challenge that we will face. I'm not so worried about innovation. The ideas that I'm seeing, I'm so optimistic about the quality of ideas that we see, and we only fund a few percent of that. The question is, if we don't do anything, these innovations will scale outside the United States. And this is an issue that we really need to address and hope I can get some help from CSIS and other places, how to scale this innovation in the United States. And traditionally, it's been slow. Energy is ubiquitous. It's a commodity. So there's an incumbency factor. And investment in systems, at least in large plants, last a long time. So there's a risk factor. And what we really need to do, and this is, if you look at the risk versus TRL level, you know, Office of Science, Applied Offices, ARPA-E, and I'm placing the private sector, venture capital, private equity, the loan guarantee program from DOE, as well as government procurement. Government is the biggest purchaser of energy. Could we use that lever in a judicious way to pull some of the disruptive technology to provide U.S. technological lead and create the high-tech part of the manufacturing, at least, out here? Because if you lose the high-tech manufacturing, it's bad for R&D. So let me just stop here with a quote, which I've used in the past, and I like to use it again, which I think was given in a very different time for different reasons, but is absolutely apt for today's time. And we take quotes like this one at our heart when we are creating the ARPA-E DNA. This is by Martin Luther King. We're now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Thank you very much. Sure. I can take a few questions.
Yeah, we just have a couple of ground rules. Please state your name and your affiliation and your question in the form of a question. While you're thinking of some questions, I want to take the prerogative of moderator and ask the first one. And a couple months ago, we had an event here focusing on green stimulus, not only here in the United States but around the world. And one of the key messages, which was echoed a great deal at the summit you had, was that stimulus was great, especially given the current market conditions and what's going on with financial markets and investment and things like that. But absent sort of this environment that perpetuates, you know, some of the scalability challenges or gets these technologies into market and this continued sustained investment, that a lot of these initiatives might be short-lived. And so with ARPA-E, especially its history of funding and its direct benefit from the stimulus program, and your focus on out years, how are you approaching sort of members of Congress and other folks about continuing the kind of funding that ARPA-E is going to need? It was certainly one of the bright parts and the pessimistic parts of the summit was, you know, people were really excited about the amount of money that you were able to get, but noted it was certainly not enough, and really hoped to see that it continued over the future. And so that has to be a big challenge for you in your capacity as the director. And so I was wondering.
Sure, I mean that's one of my most important jobs that I have today is to really explain to Congress. You know, I call them my board of directors. Mm-hmm. They're really my board of directors. And I have to explain to them what we are doing, what's the value, and where do we fit in? Because, frankly, there are other – it's not going to be just ARPA-E. And in all humility, we say that. It's going to be more than ARPA-E to change the ball game. But ARPA-E has a role to play in this disruptive side of things, into looking a little bit ahead in the future, and to be able to take risks. And because a lot of these ideas will fail, but if we never try, we'll never know. Mm-hmm. And so that's the explanation that I'm – you know, doing fairly aggressively with Congress right now. In terms of scalability, and, you know, yesterday I spent the day on Wall Street to find out what is the investment climate out there, because the venture capital world is going through a little bit of a, I would say, glitch is too strong a word, but, you know, they're rethinking about the investment because the exit strategy for them is not quite clear right now. In fact, the history of the last decade or so has been, you know, sparse in that area. So, and some ideas out here are not quite, you know, doesn't quite work with the VC model. You know, a large plant, a nuclear plant or carbon capture is not a VC game, frankly. I mean, some VCs are interested, mm-hmm. but it's not universally. Mm-hmm. So there has to be other private capital flow. And so that's part of the reason I'm trying to engage with the large investment people. And one of the things, and frankly, I've said this in my hearings, that if there's anything that keeps you awake at night, it is not the innovation. It is the scalability of these innovations out here. And one of the approaches that is there in the Podesta-Deutsch-Ogden report is that can we use the government purchases, okay, which we are the biggest buyers of energy, if he can take a fraction of that and pull and create a demand for those technologies which will allow us to get the technological lead in the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that is one instrument. There needs to be more financial instruments so that people, the risk is reduced, and so people, the average Joe or average Jane can retrofit their homes without having a big upfront cost and still be able to, you know, put that investment in their property tax and other things. Those financial instruments have to be created. Mm-hmm. So long answer to a,
yeah,
you know.
No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right there. Mm-hmm. And wait for the microphone, please.
I'm Lynn Coleman, a Washington lawyer, formerly a partner at Skadden Arps, and I serve now on some energy company boards and teach at a law school. And
can you speak a little louder?
Yeah.
Oh. I was one of the old guys that was at DOE back in the 70s when we went at this before. Do I understand you correctly that you're proposing to skip the demonstration step that we always thought was essential and was really the big dollar item? The assumption that prevailed at that time was there would have to be government assistance to go to a commercial scale unit size. And it sounds to me like you're assuming you could go from the lab to the bench.
No, I actually, thanks for asking that question. I actually, in some cases, we cannot skip that step. For example, carbon capture, and sequestration, the carbon capture part has to be at a demo level, some plant. So we're working very closely with NETL and the National Center for Carbon Capture to take some of these, to essentially creating some interaction today so that some of these technologies in carbon capture, when they are at least successful in the lab scale, to do the demonstration at a larger scale. But I would say that it is not the demonstration only of the technical performance, but really of the economics of it, because that will reduce the risk for private sector investment to come in.
Frank? Frank gets to answer questions.
I'm Frank Verastro with CSIS. Aaron, thank you very much. Great presentation. And we need new thoughts and new ideas here. I guess my question is, how do you get, following on Sarah's question, demand pull without a price of carbon? How do you get these things to be affected? If we don't get legislation this year, what do you do?
Price and carbon would go a long way. And this is came out in the summit over and over again, whether you listen to Jeff Immelt or listen to John Doerr. And I think John Doerr said, and I'm just quoting him now, the three things that are important, a price on carbon, and a price on carbon. Okay? I'm quoting him. Yes, that would send a signal to the business side that things are about to change, or things are changing, and you might as well. The actual price on carbon, whether it's $30 or $40 or whatever, may not be as important, the actual price, but the fact that there is a signal is really important. In the absence of the scientists and the engineers have to work really hard to make it economically feasible. A dollar a watt of solar PV is really hard, fully installed, not just the module cost, fully installed, which includes labor, includes many other things. So it is a much harder challenge then. And frankly, what carbon price would do is to give a little buffer. Yes, there is a trend of the PV cost, fully installed cost, coming down. But if you give that signal, it could happen in a much shorter time. And speed is really important right now.
My name is Benjamin Rubin. I come from India. At the outset, I would like to congratulate Mazumdar for this beautiful presentation, because for we Indians, we are still looking at United States, that what you are doing in the States. My question is that when we are talking of this alternative energy in solar, wind, etc., in terms of the total percentage of the power generation, it comes to just about 10%. Now, the 90% what we have, out of that 90%, about 60% is entirely on coal, which generates a lot of carbon dioxide. This I am saying because I worked for 40 years in a power sector. Then it is nuclear, very difficult in these times to go ahead, at least in India, and then gas. So how about this coal gasification, which improves the efficiency of the power plant, and you get bulk power? So in my opinion, can we divide this into bulk power segment and small power segment, or urban sector and the rural sector? You can put this distributed generation in villages.
That's right.
I would like to have
your... Sure. I mean, actually, I visited India with the secretary last November, and there was a lot of discussion on gasification. I mean, how to reduce the cost of gasified coal and coal plants and the distributed generation as well. I mean, from what I understand, the infrastructure that India would like to have by 2030, 80% of that has not been created, which frankly is a huge opportunity for the United States to work with India in doing so. I think absolutely, distributed generation needs to be done at cost. But when you have distributed generation, you also need storage. and whether it's if you're generating, you know, from PVs or wind, or you know, the cost of generation has to come down, but the cost of storage also has to come down so that people can use it at the time that they need. In India, especially, and frankly, even out here in the rural communities, the use of biomass in a judicious, inexpensive way is critical. And so there are some common features. You know, India has one of the highest reserves of coal. U.S. has the highest reserves of coal. So there are common, you know, grounds out there that we could really work together. And that's part of the, you know, frankly, the international aspects of what we're trying to do is, you know, visiting and seeing what the needs are. And I'm going to China again, China this end of this month. And I've been talking to the other countries as well. And some of them are interested in creating an ARPA-E in their own country. I said, that's great. And we will, whatever the best practices that we have, we'll be happy to share and enable the other nations to do that as well.
I'm Salim Ali from the University of Vermont, and I was in Copenhagen when Secretary Chu presented the industry meeting, and there also there was this concern from the environmentalists that if we put too much emphasis on the technologies, we are somehow shortchanging the conservation side. And going back to your quotation here, I mean, this is the real challenge, is that if we're running out of time and we don't know if the technology can solve the problem and we get complacent about those issues.
Right.
So as an educator, I deal with this constantly. I'm very much a technological optimist, but my students come back to me, they've read Bill McKibben or something, and they'll say, well, you know, you're going off the other end because now you're creating LEED certified buildings which are 10,000 square feet, and yes, they're, you know, platinum starred, but you're not focusing on conservation. So how is DOE responding to that?
Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely right. Frankly, there's a lot of data about LEED buildings. You actually go and measure the performance, not as good, actually. And I can share some data with you. I shared that in one of my Senate, you know, hearings on buildings. What is important is to reduce the total consumption, not just energy efficiency or conservation. The total consumption has to come down. And there's a technological angle to this. There's a social aspect to this. And there's a policy angle to this. So energy efficiency, conservation, there's a market inefficiency in there. So we need to address that with some policies, whether it's regulatory or incentives and things like that. I can go on and on with this. I'm going to stop. But what I'm saying, you're absolutely right. Technology has to be married to policy, behavioral, social changes as well. One more, maybe.
Martin Walker, Global Business Policy Council. Two questions, really. One, on the basis of your Indian trip, what prospects do you see of success in the Indian thorium nuclear technology?
I don't know enough to say.
Okay.
Well, okay. As you can well imagine from my looks and my accent, I am originally from India.
Yeah.
But you know that sector, that is something that I have not spent enough time, and I don't want to make any comments yet without really understanding that side.
The second question is, you mentioned the growth in the output of natural gas from hydraulic fracking in the U.S., and yet, and you mentioned also the difficulties with water, but there's a further difficulty, which is the extremely fast drop-off of output after the first couple of years or so. What real prospects do you see of this having a long-term impact upon the U.S. energy profile?
Well, we're still trying to learn that sector as to what the drop-offs are and how fast it is, and whether there are opportunities to change the course of the drop-off. We're still trying to understand. I'm not sure it is fully understood yet scientifically as to why, whether there's a drop, whether that drop-off could be changed, whether this is just natural. That's it. We're talking to some of the experts in this area to find out. So at this point, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I want to ask you all to help me join me in thanking Dr. Majumdar for coming today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
It's certainly really wonderful to see someone of such enormous talent and optimism taking on such a difficult job. We also wanted to welcome up the next panel. We'll get the transition underway here quite shortly.
Is it not?
Did you have to unhook something else from his? There shouldn't be, no, the cord to hook it to the screen.
It is my great pleasure to introduce these visionaries and representatives from the companies with breakthrough technologies this morning. From the far right, we have Michael Granoff, head of oil independence policies with Better Place, the world's leading electric vehicle service provider with a partnership with global companies such as HSBC and Renault Nissan. Next is Josh Richman, the director of business development with Bloom Energy. With its roots to the NASA Mars space program, Bloom Energy is a pioneer in the field of on-site fuel cell technology. Craig Hansen is the vice president for nuclear manufacturing for the Babcock Wilcox Nuclear Power Generation Group. Babcock and Wilcox is a company with over 140 years of experience in providing innovative technologies and solutions in the energy field. Last but not least, William Bonvillian is the director of Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Washington, D.C. office. He's a leading scholar on science and technology policies and innovation issues, with his most recent book entitled Structuring an Energy Technology Revolution, published in 2009. In the interest of time, I'd like to invite everyone in the audience to refer to the agenda for full speaker bios. Also, I'll open the floor for questions after all four presentations. Now, without further ado, Michael, please.
I saw the slides there a second ago.
Oh,
I have to open this up? Is that the...
Did I kill it? Sorry about that. Do I see the dollars?
Good morning. I'm really glad I got to hear that opening presentation because it, I think, frames this very well, at least my part of this. And I think you'll see that we share a lot of the feelings of the director and different just of a few areas that we'll get to. But what I thought I'd do is first just introduce you to what Better Place is, give you our view of the world, and of what we see ahead, and describe our solution and talk about our progress, do all that hopefully in about 15 minutes. So we're the global company delivering networks and services for electric vehicles. And for drivers, what we aim to do, as you'll hear, is to make EVs affordable, not only affordable, but actually cheaper than gasoline cars and more convenient to use. And for the industry, make it possible, as the director was referring to, what really matters is scale. Make it possible to truly scale, not to 2%, which is where hybrids have gotten to in their first 10 years, but well beyond it, because we can't afford to do just another 2%, even if it's on all EVs, not hybrids. We can't afford to do that in the next decade. As he said, we're running out of time. We got to go much faster than that. And obviously for the world, for all the reasons that we're all so familiar with. So the most important thing, I think, to understand, even more important than our specific solution, is that what we see coming here is actually a disruption. In other words, so it's not hybrids where you get to 2% in 10 years, but it's more like iTunes, where go try to find somebody under the age of 25 who even can identify a CD. That's what we're seeing in terms of the transition from gas to electric cars. So why is that the case? Yeah, this is the easiest way to describe it. We'll have a little audience participation. What is it that you think you buy when you go to the gas station? Anybody? Gas is the obvious answer. But do you ever do anything with the gas? I mean, other than put it in your tank and drive? Do you ever take it home, like put it on the mantle or give it as a gift? We just drive. You're really buying your next 300 miles. So what you'll see is what we Better Place do, look at what is actually the economics around each of those miles, and that's the same product that we sell. So you ever wonder how this happened? We all remember this. About a year ago, car industry collapsed. This is a headline that came just about 3 months later in the big investment magazine Barron's. Exxon, grab this and bargain while you can. By the way, Exxon at the time and still is the highest market cap stock in the stock market. So in other words, the most expensive stock in the world is still cheap. And they provide actually the service to be able to make cars work, and if the car industry goes broke. something in that value chain got really corrupted, got really out of whack. And the, one of the terrific things that will happen in this transition, in this disruptive move to electrification, is all of the money that's being poured into this industry and right now poured into the Gulf of Mexico, all that will instead go to the other parts of the value chain, including to the consumers and to the car makers to make them profitable. So that's, by the way, selling miles is the most profitable business in the world. $3 trillion a year at the gas station. So let's take a quick look at the economics of a mile. And we compare here on the left what you're used to, gasoline mile, though you probably don't think of it in these terms, and the new product that's coming into the market, the electric mile, the e-mile. So the cost of a gasoline mile, if you take a $3 gallon gasoline cost, a car that gets 25 miles to the gallon, the cost per mile is 12 cents. Average American is paying 13, 14 cents in that range. Today, and by the way, here's where I part company a little bit with the prior presentation, in that battery costs have already, the figures he gave were actually accurate about 3 years ago. They've already come down significantly from there. And so this is based on about $500 a kilowatt hour. And in fact, we're hearing now in the market that it's even below that. But based on that, we get a depreciation cost over each mile of about 5 cents on the battery and an electricity cost for each mile of about 3 cents based on 12 cents a kilowatt hour. So that gives you a cost on the e-mile of about 8 cents. So as you can see, even today, even in the U.S., the e-mile is cheaper than the g-mile. But, you know, the margin is not great. Obviously, the price of gas fluctuates pretty consistently, so it's hard to build a business on that. If you go to some of the places where Better Place is doing business, which we'll talk about, in Israel and Denmark, here customers are not paying 12, 13, 14 cents a mile. They're paying more like 30, 35 cents a mile. There you can see why we've been so successful in raising capital. So, but what's going to happen here? We don't know what's going to happen on the left, obviously. We don't know what the price of gasoline is going to do, what the price of oil is going to do. We do pretty much know that the 2,000 cycles that these economics are based on are changing, because we see it in the lab already. We see that the battery that gets 2,000 100-mile cycles today in the lab is getting about 4,000. And by the end of this decade, we'll probably be in the $6,000, $8,000 neighborhood. So the depreciation cost on each of those miles, that's going to come down. In fact, it's going to come down to the point at which the cost of refining gasoline is going to be higher than that cost. In other words, the electric mile will be cheaper than $0 barrel oil. That's why we see this as a disruptive move. So let's talk about Better Place's solution and what we're doing to get ready for the disruption that we see. The company was founded with the question, how do you run a country without oil? And that's a very different question, actually, to start with, than how do you scale an electric car company or how to build batteries or any of the other things. And the answer is, make the car that the consumer that doesn't use oil, make that the choice for the consumer. Make it less expensive and more convenient. So how do you do that? First thing you do is you take the battery, which, as has already been talked about, is the biggest part of this ecosystem, and you don't think of it as a really expensive component of the car. Instead, what it really is it's part of the energy infrastructure. Economically, it's like crude oil, except when you go to buy your car, you don't buy all the crude oil. So when you go to buy your car, you shouldn't buy the energy infrastructure. You shouldn't have to buy that battery. You take the battery out of the cost equation, all of a sudden you've made the electric car, at a minimum, you've made it on a par with gasoline cars. In countries like Israel and Denmark, where they have a tendency to tax gas cars very heavily, and they've said they're not going to tax electric cars for the foreseeable future, now you've made it much cheaper. And then when you get to scale, and you're not producing 1,000 of these, or 10,000, but you're producing hundreds of thousands, then you're going to make it cheaper still, because an electric car is really a big consumer electronic device on wheels. And what happened with consumer electronic devices, whether it's plasma televisions or anything else, remember what the price points they started, and we know what they are today. So that's what we're going to see happen. Again, that's going to smooth the way for this disruption. So Better Place buys all the batteries. That's the first thing we do. We buy the batteries, you buy the car much cheaper. Second thing we do is we put infrastructure. The infrastructure consists of two parts. One is ubiquitous charge points. These are actual pictures of Israel today. We've got more than 1,000 in the ground that are just being tested, and by the end of this year, we'll be putting many, many thousands more in preparation for cars next year. So we put these, first of all, most importantly, at home and at work, but we also put them at the movie theaters, and that's actually movie theater on the left there. On the right, it's actually a public street. So we put these wherever you go. So every time you come back to your car, you actually have the full range of the battery, about the 100-mile range. We could talk later about how I don't think the relevant question is when do we get to the 300 or 400-mile battery, because I think when we do, you'll still want the 100-mile battery. It's the right size for the car. Same reason the battery for your phone. If you got about 24 or 36 hours of standby time, you don't really want more than that. You like the convenience of being able to put it in your pocket. So you wouldn't want a phone if I gave it to you that had a month of standby time, but you know couldn't fit in your pocket or it cost a lot more. So 100-mile range. Every time you come back to the car, you got the same 100 miles, and it's like you got somebody from Exxon following you around, topping you off. But what happens when you have to go on a longer trip? Because sometimes you do have to go more than 100 miles in one shot. Happens for most people, it's not that often, but you do. You have to solve that problem. So then you go to one of these. This is a battery switch station. We actually have, I'll show you a picture in a moment, we've got one of these set up in the center of Tokyo today that's servicing four taxi cabs that are driving around the streets of Tokyo. And it takes about a minute to switch out the battery. You don't really care about the battery because you don't own it. Battery is just part of the infrastructure you're using. You're subscribing to Better Place for your miles. You're buying miles from Better Place the same way you buy minutes from your cell phone provider. And the battery is just the means by which you do it, just like the cell towers or the chip in your phone is the means which you collect the minutes on your phone. So another key element of this is interfacing with the electric utility. Because, for example, when we announced in Israel, with the support of the government, with Renault standing next to us saying they're building cars, we announced that we had a goal to actually get Israel completely off of oil by the end of this decade. The electric company got very nervous. And they said, what are you talking about? We can't put 2 million cars on the grid. And we said, actually, you can. And they said, what do you mean? They did a study, and what the study found is with our system, I'll show you the data in one second. With our system, you could actually drive every car in Israel on the existing infrastructure you have today. This is ad hoc charging. You would have to add that much additional generation. If you just offered financial incentives, you still have to add a lot. But what do? We take the software so we can talk in real time between our control center that's talking to all the charge spots and all the batteries in the infrastructure, and we can talk to the utility, and we can match those up so we prioritize the cars, and from moment to moment, we charge only the number of cars that there's excess capacity to serve in the system. Overnight, that's most of the cars. During the day, there might be moments when it's very few of the cars. But at the same time, most of those cars have been charged before. Most of them have relatively full batteries, and you only end up charging the ones that really need it, the ones that are really low, or the guy who knows he's about to take a longer trip. And when you connect that software, and it's funny because we raise hundreds of millions of dollars, we put really expensive hardware in the ground, but this is really the heart of it. It's the software behind it that allows you to operate all the cars, optimize the existing infrastructure without having to go and build new electricity generation. And then, of course, we bring it to the consumer level to make it a convenient and enjoyable experience for the consumer, basically integrating navigation services, energy management, and OnStar on steroids. So these are all the elements of the system. Hopefully it's renewable energy. Obviously that's something we can talk about. Because of a lot of the issues, the director spoke moments ago about how important energy storage is for scaling renewable electricity. And I love that analogy, which I'm going to make use of the bladder. Imagine if you could actually drive your car on the bladder. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about that the battery in your car, which the economics I just demonstrated actually makes sense to mass adopt these. But imagine you got a second use for it, which is storing the electrons from the renewable electricity. That's what Denmark is most primarily interested in because they're 20% wind already. They try to build more windmills, and they end up having to pay Germany to take those electrons off their hands at night when they don't have the demand and they don't have any place to put them. Now, they'll put them right into the cars connected to our smart grid for cars, and they'll be able to essentially TiVo them because of their very advanced grid, and you can use the wind energy from the night before to serve peak periods during the afternoon. So quick look at our progress. These are all the countries that we have something going on in. The biggest ones are Israel and Denmark right now. And we have this demonstration, as I described, for taxis in Tokyo. Australia, we're coming, and hopefully North America, which is a more complicated situation, not because it's big and complex, but because, as again, the price of gasoline here is so much less than it is in other places, and that's what we're competing against. So, you know, we're about 2.5 years old. Here's some of our milestones. Most importantly, in January this year, we raised I have to get this confirmed, but somebody told me it was the largest single financing round for a pre-revenue stage company, $350 million from HSBC, which I think is a validation of the point I was making at the beginning in terms of getting into this business of selling miles, the world's most profitable business. And just a couple of things that have happened in just the last weeks, the Tokyo Taxi Project, and we signed an MOU with Chery Automotive, the largest private maker of cars in China. Again, this theme of U.S. competitiveness, we're seeing China, we're seeing France, last week, in fact, we saw Germany, orient national policy towards electrifying transportation for national security, for environment, for economic leadership. And I think the U.S. has to do more of that. Here's a quick picture of our battery switch station in Tokyo that's operating as we speak. I didn't talk about our partnership with Renault, but Renault has been our partner from the beginning to mass produce battery switchable all electric vehicles. And this is a 5-passenger luxury sedan that they are in the third of 4-year production cycle on. It comes into mass production next year, and by the fourth quarter next year, it will be in the hands of consumers in Israel and Denmark. And we actually placed an order, very unusual thing, at the Frankfurt Motor Show last fall. We placed an order for 100,000 of these vehicles for those markets alone. Finally, I'd invite you all to come to Israel and see this visitor center. It's an amazing, amazing place. We opened in January. We've had about 15,000 people through so far. It's designed by the folks who designed the Apple retail stores, so it's a sexy facility. And it is intended to educate consumers, to educate them first on the macro issues that you're all very familiar with around oil dependence, and second of all on electric cars, culminating in the actual experience you see in the lower right of a test track and a bunch of electric cars. They can unplug them, get in, and drive them around. I've been lucky in the last year to be in this program through BMW with the electric Minis. So I've got this little electric Mini that I've been driving for about a year. And I've found that there's this psychological thing. People, you know, very quickly understand why we have to move off of oil. And they understand why the only thing that can scale to make it do that is electrification. But you always think there's got to be trade-off somewhere. So subconsciously, you think it's going to be in the performance of the car. So you enter the car in that mindset. And then what you find is that the car is completely silent and that the acceleration is instant torque and it's a more fun, better driving experience. And then there's just an immediate conversation, well, why aren't we doing this? Why do I have the only electric car in New Jersey? You know, why aren't there... And how soon can I get one? And that's the question that people are asking here at the visitor center, which is exactly, frankly, what we intended, so we can start signing people up for the 100,000 cars that we ordered. So that's what we're doing at Better Place, and look forward to the conversation later on.
Thank you for – my name is Josh Richmond from Bloom Energy. Thank you for having me this morning. And I think, as Mike alluded to, you're gonna see recurring themes of innovation, speed, and global competitiveness throughout my talk and presumably throughout the rest of this morning. Briefly about Bloom. Bloom Energy was founded with the mission of making clean energy, clean, reliable energy affordable throughout the world. It's a pretty bold mission. And the way we do that is we use a solid oxide fuel cell technology that has its roots in the NASA mission to Mars, and I'll get into that a little bit later. We were founded around 8 years ago. Our initial investment came from a venture capital firm called Kleiner Perkins. If you're not familiar with them, they've not only invested in some of the biggest, most successful companies that have created breakthrough disruptive technologies, but they've really created whole new industries. We were their first clean tech investment. They did invested in Sun, Compaq, Genentech, Amazon, Google. You know, they were the early investors in all those companies that really changed the world through technology. Since us, they've invested in around 50 other clean tech companies. So this is a sector that they're very committed to. And we remained in stealth mode for around 8 years. We can get into that if you're interested as well later in the conversation. But essentially, clean tech has been overhyped and underdelivered for decades, and Bloom took the approach of just waiting until we actually had validated proof points out before we lifted the curtains. We did that in February of 2010, first through a 60 Minutes segment, and then after that, 3 days later, a large national launch that led to around 1,400 different press stories and a change in our world, because we went from not saying anything to suddenly having people knowing what we were doing, which has been an exciting shift. But essentially, the problem that we're trying to address is the way energy is generated and delivered right now throughout the world. There's centralized power plants which are dirty, inefficient. Nobody really wants one in their backyard, and essentially you take chemical energy in the form of fuel. You combust that, you convert that chemical energy into thermal energy. Thermal energy then turns a turbine, which is mechanical energy, and then there's a coil around that, which becomes electrical energy. And then when you go from chemical to thermal to mechanical to electrical energy, then you actually have to transmit that energy from the point of generation down to the end user, which in the U.S. Leads to 8 to 10% additional loss. In the developing world, it's up to 40%. So it's just a very inefficient process. Not to mention the fact that it's inefficient, expensive, and dirty, it's also susceptible to cyber and physical attack. So what we're doing is essentially trying to bring the power to the people. The distributed paradigm isn't unique. You saw it happen in computing, where you went from centralized mainframes to laptops. We all now have laptops. In telephony, everyone needed a landline, and now cell phones are ubiquitous. I mean, in the developing world, you essentially bypass landlines. You can't get a landline. Land in one of these countries and you get a cell phone at the airport. And we see the same thing happening in energy, where you no longer are required to be connected to the centralized distribution network, and you can bring power and take control of your own power. If you look at what happened in computing and telephony, the way that we shifted, the paradigm shifted, was you hit this threshold of affordability and reliability. The early cell phones weren't very reliable and they're very expensive. Now you can basically get one for free as long as you pay for the minutes. In energy, we see that same requirement of affordability and reliability, but it also has to be clean and it has to be easy. Clean because, not just because, we all think that we need to decrease our CO2 footprint, but because if you're going to bring this centralized power plant next to your window, whether or not you want to be an altruist, the fact is you don't want to breathe dirty air. So you need to have this, if you're going to bring the power to next to where you're consuming it, it has to be clean in addition to be reliable and affordable and easy. And the way we do that is through a fuel cell technology. I've got my prop for you here. This is a one of our fuel cells. This produces around 25 watts. The way it works is fuel goes on one side, oxygen goes on the other. They're at temperatures and electrochemical reaction. The oxygen ions go across the fuel cell, bond with the fuel, and produce electricity. Now, fuel cells have been around since the Gemini mission, or really for over 100 years. They've been in every NASA mission since the Gemini mission. Essentially, what we're doing is fundamentally different in three main ways. And the first is the materials. This is a flat, square piece of sand. It's no mistake that our company's based in Silicon Valley, where we know how to manufacture flat square pieces of sand at high volume and low cost. We've got a lot of people from the semiconductor industry who have come over to Bloom to help drive down costs and manufacture these flat square pieces at high volume and low cost. The second main distinction is it's a high temperature fuel cell. Now, we'll never make sense in a car. It's high temperature. When you turn this thing on, you have to wait 12 hours or more to get up to temperature before you start producing power. So we're not going to be used for backup. We're not going to be used for transportation unless you want to start your car and wait 12 hours before you drive. But we're a 24/7 baseload solution. Now, the benefit of that high temperature is that we're around twice as efficient as those legacy fuel cell technologies, and we're fuel flexible, meaning these fuel cells can run really on anything that has a hydrogen and or a carbon in it. You know, our engineers in the lab one day ran the system on a bottle of Belvedere vodka. I mean, it's, you know, I think we'd all agree that isn't the best use of that, but it's something that we can do. We can run on natural gas. We can run on renewable fuels. We can run on propane. Really, anything that has a carbon and or hydrogen, it can be a fuel source. Now, the third major distinction of this core technology really goes back to the NASA roots. Our founders were working on the NASA mission to Mars. Essentially, NASA realized that to go to the moon is like a day trip. You could bring everything you need with you, all the food, fuel, oxygen, take everything back, you're fine. But to go to Mars, you have to figure out how to sustain life on Mars using the resources that are readily available there. So they took this fuel cell technology, coupled it with a solar panel, because there's some sun on Mars. Electricity was the input, and the output was oxygen so you could breathe and sustain life on Mars, and fuel so you could actually fuel a ship from the Mars surface and send it into the atmosphere. So they saw that that technology could take electricity in and produce oxygen and fuel and said, well, we could take oxygen and fuel and produce electricity. So this core technology is the first fuel cell that can be used in both directions, either generation or storage. And, you know, low-cost materials, temperature, and reversibility really are the three main distinctions. And when we talk about this vision of the company, this is a picture that was in Newsweek a couple years ago that really talks about the home of the future, where you have solar panels on the roof. Instead of net metering the excess electrons onto the grid, essentially you could run those excess electrons through your fuel cell, your bloom box, if you will, in your garage, produce a low-pressure hydrogen on site. When the sun goes down, the solar panels stop producing electricity. Then that fuel can run through the fuel cell in the earth direction and produce electricity. So you have a 24/7 renewable resource at home. And then whether there are hydrogen cars in the future and you want to use that hydrogen to fuel your hydrogen vehicle, or if there are electric cars in the future and you want to charge your car, this could also be the gas station at home as well. So this is the vision. Now, this isn't what we're doing right now, but you know, the core technology here really is a flexible energy platform. It can run on any type of fossil fuel, any type of renewable fuel. It can run on hydrogen. It can take an intermittent renewable resource and use that as the input, and then the output can be AC, DC power. You can change voltage, current. You can produce hydrogen. You can produce oxygen. And yeah, it's a fundamentally flexible technology. And the question is, what do you commercialize first? As a pragmatic venture-backed company, we can't do all these things at once. We have to figure out what's the best way to enter the market and reach profitability. And this is our first commercial product. It's something around the size of a parking space. Takes fuel in, produces 100 kilowatts of electricity at high efficiencies and low emissions, and it's carbon neutral if you use a renewable fuel. So really, it's fuel flexible. Now, these are some of our early announced customers. I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of these companies. And you know, the picture on the bottom right is our installation at eBay. They have five boxes, so it's 500 kilowatts. Essentially, you could cluster these boxes like you do servers in a data center, and whatever your minimum baseload is for the building you're serving, you can cluster these and meet that baseload. If you have a 2-megawatt load, give us 20 parking spaces. We'll produce 2 megawatts cleanly, efficiently, 24/7. So briefly, I think we covered some of these, but the thing that makes us unique from legacy fuel cell technologies are a few things. First, we're all electric. Many other distributed generation technologies operate in a combined heat and power function, meaning you have to figure out what to do with a thermal load, match a thermal load and electrical load, and really custom engineer every installation. We're a box, fuel in, electricity out, more efficiently than any other distributed generation technology out there. So that's one of the main distinctions, which doesn't limit which allows us to really be installed at any type of customer. We're not limited by a need to find a thermal load. We do that at an unmatched efficiency. We're fuel flexible. There's a modular, scalable nature of these technologies. So again, as we discussed, you could do a couple hundred kilowatts. You could do multiple megawatts, depending on what the baseload is. It's a plug-and-play solution, and it's cost-effective. So we can get more into that later. So in the remaining time, one of the things that I was asked to talk about is what kind of policies do we need for companies like Bloom and other companies out there in the clean tech space to succeed? completely agree that the first, second, and third thing should be putting a price on carbon. Beyond that, I'll give you three others. I'm not going to get into these well-documented environmental national security implications of our current energy policy. I think people in this room can speak to that much more intelligently than I can. So instead, I was going to focus on America's role as a global leader. We've led, you know, whether it's space race, whether it's in the military, whether it's IT, America has been the global leader. And unfortunately, we can't de facto assume that because we have led with innovation and commercialization until this point, that the same is going to happen with clean tech. And clean tech represents the greatest economic opportunity in the 21st century. Google's addressable market is a fraction compared to what the global energy market is. And we all know that Google's a pretty successful company. There are going to be many, many clean tech companies that are going to be just as successful, if not more successful. And the question is, will they be American companies, and will we capture the economic value and be able to be a global leader in the future based on our success in clean tech? A few stats for you. China is out investing us. 1999, they were 1% of the world's solar panels were invested in China, and last year, which is the most recent available data, 2008, the most recent year that data was available, they had a 32% market share. Of the top 10 wind energy, solar energy, and battery companies, two of the solar companies are American, one wind and one battery company. The rest are not in America. And then while America is increasing its wind capacity and other generating capacities, I think many would agree not at the right pace, but we are increasing our consumption and generation of clean energy. Less than half of the 8,500 gigawatts of wind turbines that were used in the U.S. last year were actually manufactured in the U.S. So this is a global race, and the need to act is now, as the director said in his opening remarks. So what should we do? In addition, again, to putting a price on carbon, I've got three suggestions we'll dive into very quickly. One, lead by example. The other is continue to increase demand, but also production in the United States of these technologies, not just an RPS, an RES, or a feed-in tariff, which are critically important, and I don't want to demean that, but also focusing on domestic manufacturing of these technologies that can help us meet these goals. And then third is providing access to growth capital, something that other countries are doing faster than we are. So, again, as Dr. Majumdar said, America is the federal government is the largest consumer of energy. We spend over $200 billion each year. So, my number one recommendation would be to use that buying power when buying power. I mean, the opportunity to shape a market just based on our consumption practices should not be understated, and I think that could actually be more effective than any single piece of legislation could be. Now, the key is not to prescribe the solutions, and one of the things that he talked about regularly was the importance for technology neutrality and just setting the bar and saying, I don't care what technology can meet it, but if you're trying to reduce carbon, state what the goal is, or increase efficiency, state what the goal is, and let technologists achieve those goals and really become the solution rather than prescribing from the beginning. We need to have X percent of solar, X percent of wind, X percent of fuel cells. That's not the way to just create a balance, a level playing field, and let people compete. Second would be, in addition to that consumption, focus, in addition to being a leading consumer and focusing on that side, focus on where those technologies are produced. We can create a lot of green collar jobs by building wind farms, but by being the producer of those wind turbines, it creates a whole new slew of opportunities for job creation and economic growth. I know there's talk about manufacturing tax credits. Everyone seems to be in favor of it. The first round was three times oversubscribed in the U.S. The lack of certainty of when that's going to happen and who is going to get those is causing people to make business decisions that they have to make while there's this uncertainty around whether or not there's going to be domestic support for manufacturing. And then the third and last thing is, there is access to capital. The China Development Bank over the last few months has announced $11.5 billion of low-cost financing for their local solar companies. The DOE Loan Guarantee Program is intended to do the same thing. It's and I think we keep hearing and seeing improvement in that process, but I think China is just acting a lot quicker and more decisively than we are. So those are three humble suggestions in addition to obviously putting a price on carbon, and there are many other things that we can do and should be doing. But you know, Bloom Energy is a company that I think has a tremendous future, and we'd like that future to be enabled by strong domestic policy. So thank you.
I really feel like the odd man out here. You got all of these new companies and new agencies, and our company is about 140 years old. You got all this talk about distributed energy and how that's going to make everything better, and our company built the first centralized power station in New York for Thomas Edison to power the subway that they were building at the time. And you had some examples of products here, and I would have liked to have brought an example of my product in here, but it weighs about 130 tons at the minimum. And so it wouldn't have fit into the room. B&W has a long-standing reputation for innovation. We would not have been around for 140 years if that was not the case. Our logo or our slogan a couple of years back was Powering Transformation. But really, inside of our company, the attitude is you must innovate or you will die. And we are in one of those transformational periods right now. We have a long history of transformation. We built that first centralized power plant, moving from a drum technology to a boiler pipe technology. We did marine boilers. Many of you probably heard of Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet. That was powered by B&W boilers, which was a transformative technology, its application on the marine side. We were involved in building the heavy components for the first meaningful reactors in the world, both for government purposes and for the first meaningful commercial nuclear reactor, the Shippingport reactor, up in Pennsylvania. We built almost 40% of the coal-fired plants in the country. And as pressure when it came down on cleaning up those plants, we developed what I believe is probably the world's largest environmental control solutions company that goes off and supplies the components to clean up those. We have built, and I'm talking all about this because we're talking about innovation, and I'm going to give into a specific example of innovation and transformative technologies. We have built and demonstrated a carbon capture power plant based upon oxy-coal combustion that will capture in excess of 95% of the carbon dioxide, and we've demonstrated 30 megawatts, and we publicly said that we will sell to anyone who wants to buy it a plant that will produce anywhere between 100 and 350 megawatts of electricity, and that will do the same. We haven't had any takers yet. There is a little bit of premium to going off and doing carbon capture. It's about a 40% capital premium and a 50 to 60% annual operating premium because of the parasitic loads on the plants. So we're very familiar with changing so that our company can continue to grow. And what I wanted to talk with you about today was another change, an innovation that we believe will help us to continue to grow in the future. innovation is not easy, especially when you're a big company. And it's a complex process, because have you really achieved innovation? Have you really achieved innovation unless your technology is implemented? There's a lot of focus nowadays on the technology and what technologies will work. But can you say that you have really been innovated unless you can actually bring it to market and make a positive change for society and the country that you work in? And so that's really what you need to do. You really need to understand your market, the drivers. And so when we look at the market, we saw favorable regulatory, geopolitical, and market realities. Lots of change. It's almost chaos now in the energy industry. What's going to happen? What are going to be the requirements next year? What are our customers going to ask of us? And what are the consumers going to ask of them? We have broad BMW capabilities, workforce, and America infrastructure. We're a U.S. company. We have a lot of interest from our utility customers. They encouraged us to go down this path, and they are stepping up with commitments. And we are experts at practical design, and what we want to do is have a robust licensing philosophy. But let's talk about a little bit more in detail about what was changing in the nuclear landscape. Obviously, climate change. Legislation. If you put a price on carbon, you are fundamentally changing the approach to electricity generation in the country. And you're taking the low-cost provider of electricity, and you could very well make that the high-cost provider of electricity. And that is a fundamental change for this country. You really can't overemphasize how much of an impact that would have. You've got the desire of all countries to be energy independent. And all you have to do is look to Europe and Russia in the supply of natural gas to see what happens when you aren't entirely independent, or look into our own country with our reliance on petroleum. You have a strained supply chain in the United States because typically we haven't been in the manufacturing business for a long time. But I've got some good news to report there. Field craft labor availability. All these power plants, when we originally built them, you assemble teams, and it was very easy to assemble teams out in the field and to do that on a low-cost basis. That is no longer the case. It is very expensive to assemble those teams out in the field, if you can assemble them at all, and then to train those teams and then to move them from one place to another. Transmission capacity. In a lot of cases, if you look at the overall project, it's not just about how much the power plant costs. It's about how much the transmission capacity costs also. And then all you guys have heard about water and land rights. And we'll talk about how this particular application applies to water and land rights. And tight capital markets, everybody knows about that. The industry imperatives that drove us to this solution is nobody wants to bet the company on one project. Has anyone here heard that nuclear power plants can be expensive? Okay, so, so it's a big investment to go off and make. They run for a long time. They're very reliable. They're highly efficient, and once you get them built, they're great plants to have, but they are expensive. And a lot of companies don't want to or can't bet the company on building a single power plant. They want to have a practical, proven technology. They don't want to have something that they have to spend a lot of time going off and developing and worrying about and thinking and demonstrating. They want to use the existing nuclear infrastructure to the extent that they can. They want to repower carbon-intensive facilities. Carbon-intensive facilities, that's a code word for coal or natural gas or any other type of facility that you have out there that produces a lot of carbon dioxide. And they want to do incremental power additions. If you're out in the utility industry, what have you seen them building? Gas plants. They're small. They're small additions. It's not a big capital expense. They can be used for peaking. So they like that incremental addition. When you step up to the plate and say, I want to build anywhere from 1,000 to 1,700 megawatts, that's a difficult equation to put together. The vertical integrated supply chain. We're targeting domestic forgings or roll plate. We have the capability to do component fabrication at any of three facilities in North America. There's always been over the last 5 or 6 or 7 years, there's been a lot of questions of whether we have the ability to manufacture components here in the United States. And I've tried to put that to bed over and over and over again, but I can answer you with 100% assurity that we have the ability to manufacture heavy components, heavy nuclear components here in the United States, and have been doing so continuously for over the last 40 years. And our capability to manufacture right now, I've been at the plants, I run those plants, is the equivalent of any manufacturing capability in the world. We can build any component that's manufactured in the world. So it's important to understand that. Fuel fabrication, control rod drive, modular manufacturing. We're going to talk a little bit about modular manufacturing. We're also a global business, and we recognize what it takes to do business internationally, especially in the power industry. We have a long history of it. We have a lot of what I call illegitimate children out there, people who signed licensing agreements and use our name, Babcock. So if you go out there and you see, you'll see Babcock Hitachi, you'll see a whole bunch of folks out there that use the name Babcock because they've licensed our technology over the years and they have the right to use that name. Integral pressurized water reactors. How many of you guys know what an integral pressurized water reactor is? I'm seeing a couple of hands out there, but basically that means you put the whole thing together and you generate steam right inside the actual reactor. We have experience in designing integral pressurized water reactors. We've started our design, kind of our modular design for the NS Savannah, which was a merchant marine ship, and we also did the design for the Otto Hahn, which uses an integral reactor. The design that we're looking at right now is called the M-Power reactor. It's an integral 125 megawatt modular reactor. It uses proven technology. A key goal of our organization is to make this as easy as possible to license. So we're innovating, but we're innovating by using existing technologies in a new way. A very simple, passively safe design utilizes standard PWR fuel and a very long operating cycle compared to other reactors. And we have promised, this is very important, okay, is that we are going to build this in North America in B&W factories. And not only with B&W factories, but we are working with our sub-tier suppliers here in North America to see if we can build as much as possible within this country. And I spent almost 300 days away from my house last year going and visiting sub-tier vendors, talking to customers, and the conclusion that I came away having visited all these folks is that we have a very robust capability that is capable of going off and doing that. A much better capability than most people think that we have in this industry right now. These are some of the details on this design. And why is, let's step back for a second. Why is this design transformative or potentially transformative? It's smaller, okay? Its inner diameter is 10 feet outside. It's about 15 feet, depending on where you cut the nozzles and whether you include the skirt or not. It can be manufactured in a centralized facility. So you remember me talking about the issues of having to build and put together all the field craft? Well, you can put this in a centralized facility, and you can manufacture it all in that facility and ship to the site as a single unit. You don't have separate steam generators. You don't have separate pumps. So it is truly modular. And it can be transported either by rail or by truck. Why is that meaningful? Because that allows us to reduce the cycle time that it would actually take to manufacture the reactor. And when you reduce the cycle time, You reduce the amount of time that the utility has to have money invested in the project before it is earning return. And that is probably the largest single contributor to the levelized cost of energy calculations that a utility will go through. So cycle time is critically important if you want to build a reactor cost effectively. And when you're building smaller reactors, that cost effectiveness is very important because you have other challenges to go off and overcome. Let's see if there's any. If you look at the nuclear island features, some of this is probably too much detail, but the important things are passive decay heat removal. So you don't need to have pumps powered by electricity for your safety systems, and that's a big thing because then you have no emergency AC power. You can rely on batteries alone, so you don't have to have emergency diesels. The reactor is installed after construction. You look at that little lid. You pop the lid off the top. You slide the reactor right in there into construction. You weld the steam pipes, and then you run. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but generally that's what's happened. And we have spent nuclear fuel storage for 60 years, the full plant life, inside that containment building. It's a scalable plant with fully independent reactor modules. So you don't have to build a 1,700 or 1,000 megawatt plant. And in some cases, there's not the market for that big of a plant. When we talked about these coal fire plants earlier, okay, a lot of those older coal fire plants that have higher emission rates that may be grandfathered in on a regulatory basis, and that may be being replaced at some point in the future, they are in the range of 150 to maybe 300, 350 megawatts. And so if you're going to replace that with a carbon-free electricity generating capability, you can't do that with a big reactor. You have to do it with a smaller reactor. And that is the primary target that we're going after right now. But there are other targets, smaller utilities out in the West, that we will probably take a look at too, that may not need a full 1,000 megawatts and that may not have access to the water. Because the basic design here is an air-cooled system. That's critically important where you have water right issues. We have 1 to 8 modules per plant, 125 to 1,000 megawatts electric, underground containment building, what I just described, the low-impact air-cooled condenser. There's a water version if you want to have a couple extra, if you have access to water. And it's scalable to grid. And we have the 3-year construction schedule. That cycle time is very short. And that's going to be a big challenge. This is just kind of the typical lead plant. We're looking to get the lead plants operational in around the 2020 time frame. So this is our company's latest example of very thoughtful innovation that takes a look at the industry. These are the types of projects that we excel at. It's the reason that we've survived for 140 years, and it's the reason that we'll survive for another 140 years because it's kind of built into our blood. Flexible, affordable, practical, and proven. Innovation is kind of a different approach to innovation. A solid innovation based upon proven practices. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. I want to sort of provide a kind of framing picture for what we've heard today and talk about some of the underlying innovation systems issues as we begin to think about how you'd get energy innovation really introduced at scale. Just a few data points on the R&D situation as we face it at the moment. This is public and private. Blue line is public R&D. Gray line is private R&D. History since 70. since 75. The picture is slightly better since 2007, roughly. But we're at the peak point in 1980. We're at about half in real dollars of the R&D funding that we spent on new energy technologies at that time period. And the industry picture is likewise down. If you look at private sector company investment in new energy R&D, you know, it's not a great picture. Innovating industries spend a very substantial part of annual revenues on R&D. Biotech sector, 39%. Semiconductor sector, 16%. These are sectors that are introducing lots of major technology advances. Overall, in the private sector and energy, annual revenue investment in R&D for new energy technologies is less than 1%. So that's considerably lower than the rate for almost all other industries in the U.S., in part because revenues are very high. But nonetheless, there's an underlying reality here that the private sector investment level isn't a terribly pretty picture as well. You know, when the federal government invests in a major technology advance, what does that look like, right? When the feds decide they want to do a big technology advance, well, look, in 2002 dollars, the Apollo program, now this is both R&D and implementation, but the Apollo program is $185 billion over 9 years. The Carter-Reagan defense buildup was $445 over 8 years. Doubling NIH was $138 over five. By far, our current largest technology program is ballistic missile defense. So far, we're $145 billion into that over the first 6 years. That's in actual dollars. So those are, you know, that's what the feds do when they want to do some big technology thrust. Now, let me just emphasize that we would never organize an energy technology thrust in the kind of way that these programs are organized. It requires, because all this technology has to land in the private sector, not a government contractor model, it's a very different kind of approach. So, but this gives you an idea of when the feds want to do something, what do they spend? We're clearly not close to those levels, in energy technology advance. In 2008, IEA did a big study, many of you are familiar with it, I'm sure, that tried to scope out just how big an investment both R&D and implementation was going to have to be to do a 50% reduction in CO2 emissions. And they estimated, this is a worldwide cost, all countries, at $45 trillion in today's dollars. So that's 1.1% of GDP. You know, that's $1 trillion a year and change, and we're not close to spending those levels. So, you know, we've got a big front-end problem here on the R&D scaling side if you really want to transform a major part of the economy. This is not only a U.S. problem. This is a worldwide problem. This is IEA's numbers. You know, you look at that black line on R&D investment levels since 78 through 2006. So that's down in almost not quite as substantially as in the U.S., but also down. The point here is that, you know, getting to energy R&D and technology implementation at scale is going to be a big issue here. But just throwing money at energy R&D is not going to do it because innovation in energy has to land in this complex established sector. And that is much more complicated than what we typically do in standing up new energy, in standing up new innovations. Why is that? The U.S. is a technology-covered wagon kind of economy. We're good at standing up, by no means perfect, we're pretty good at standing up completely new things with new kind of functionality. And we typically stand up new things in open fields, in open territories, like computing, right? There was nothing really quite like computing before we did computing and the follow-on IT revolution, right? So, you know, in effect, we're always, you know, looking to leave our neighborhoods and go west and found a whole new kind of technology sector. And we rarely take our covered wagons. We're good at taking the covered wagons from east to west. We rarely take those technology-covered wagons and bring them back west to east. because innovations in the U.S. like to land in unoccupied territory, and energy is a profoundly occupied territory. Energy technology will be parachuting new technologies into occupied territory. It's going to get shot at. It's going to be a complicated landing problem. You know, just as another example, we do biotech. We don't go back and fix the healthcare delivery system. We move on, right? And that's, you know, it's a great thing about this country. It's got an ability to keep moving on and creating new territory. And the list that Arun Majumdar ran off of inventions of the last century, I mean, you know, the staggering number of those came out of this country, and we're good at moving into new territory. We're not good at moving innovation into established territory. And it's complicated because energy, in this sector, the energy sector in particular, because energy is a very complex established sector. And new entrants into this sector are up against a very well-established technical, economic, political paradigm. And alternative technologies are going to have to be price competitive, you know, at the outset, as we've heard a fair amount today. And the existing sector is heavily subsidized and very powerful politically. It's a tough landing problem. Now, we talked, obviously, about the need for a price on CO2, but let me just emphasize that a pricing mechanism is going to be necessary, but is not sufficient, right? We're going to have a parallel technology strategy along with that pricing strategy. And if we don't have the technology strategy, the pricing strategy is not going to work. And that's what I want to kind of focus on today is what's that look like. Okay, so we've seen some very interesting progress at the Department of Energy on the kind of front end of the innovation system, the kind of R&D and earlier on kind of invention, discovery, innovation, early innovation stages. You know, Arun gave us a wonderful talk about what the dramatic stuff that he's up to at ARPA and he and his team. It's a fascinating story. In addition to that, Secretary Chu and others have worked on standing up some other key pieces here on the front end, right, which represent important steps to improve DOE's capability. Energy Frontier Research Centers are housed. There's 46 of them now. They're about $3 million a year to universities to get universities engaged in the kind of breakthrough fundamental energy technology-related science that we're going to need here to build the innovation system that we're going to need, right? It's a real focus within the Office of Science to get the university community engaged in a very systematic, well-organized kind of way. An interesting idea, right? A sound focal point, I think. We have proposals for energy innovation hubs, right? The Secretary has pushed very hard. That territory is really about, let's kind of look at where these pieces fall. That's a $30 million a year kind of enterprise. And, you know, once you know what the pathway is going to be, let's get some focus. Let's get some talent. Let's make a bigger set of investments to kind of do not simply the breakthroughs, but the incremental improvements that are going to be needed so you can move towards commercialization. Another interesting idea, right? And then the ARPA-E piece, in some ways, is a crossover, right? You can begin to envision ARPA-E as, you know, within the existing system of DOE, you got a traditional fundamental science organization in the Office of Science, and then you got an applied organization at ERE, right? And historically, those have been very stovepiped, right? And they have different clientele. ERE works with industry. Energy Frontier Research Centers work with their labs and work with universities. And it's very hard to get across those stovepipes in DOE. They don't, you know, communicate much. And OMB bears part of the blame. They've done a lot of policing to make sure that, heaven forbid, there be, you know, overlap and duplication. So there's not a lot of connection between the two. The interesting part of these new pieces is that may help in the communication process. ARPA-E in particular can play a role in kind of scouting with the Office of Science what is really promising that's starting to come out of the fundamental stage, the breakthrough stage, and accelerating what can be done in 3 to 5 years, accelerating those breakthroughs, and then doing a handoff with the ERE. You know, an interesting idea that can improve the whole system on the front end at DOE, and the other pieces are interesting as well. So, you know, 18 months into Secretary Chu's tenure, and not all of these pieces came from him. Secretary Bodman was and the Office of Science in the last administration played the key role in designing the Energy Frontier Research Centers. But we've got some good pieces, I think, coming on the table in the front-end system here that will make it stronger, make it better. But the problem with innovation in a complex established sector is not only in the front end, it's deeply on the back end. And DOE has been focused so far on the front end. And as Arun started to suggest, they're going to need to build, and I think have begun to build, a focus on the back end of the innovation system. You know, the back end being, you know, the demonstration, the test bed, the actual commercialization and stand-up process to introduce something at something that begins to resemble scale. And what are the pieces that are going to be in place that are going to be needed here? I mean, some of the other institutions that DOE has begun work on or needs to think more about, financing, right? We've heard that repeatedly today. The House and Senate energy bills that are pending, you know, have, in effect, banks in them to give DOE a broad set of tools in the financing territory in addition to its loan guarantee authority. We've heard discussions about the possibility of DOD serving as a test bed and a procurement entity for as an initial purchaser of new technologies. DOE has just begun to think with DOD what that looks like. DOD has now signed on to the president's energy order that's going to require a major improvement in efficiency in DOD facilities within the next couple of decades. Really major improvement in its facilities and operations. The binding part of the executive order is on its facilities, but it's looking at operations as well. And DOD is not going to do this to be nice to the American economy. DOD will do this because it's good for DOD, and DOD has started to understand in a very deep way that it has both a serious tactical and strategic problem on the energy front and really needs to go after that. So they're starting to think along these lines at DOD, which means that there are possibilities for DOD being a home, a test bed for new energy technology. And then secondly, potentially a procurement agency for it. DOD gets, you know, a MILCON appropriations bill every year of $20 billion, right? That's a staggering amount of cash flow. You know, let's say some piece of that action began to move in the direction of improving DOD's costs and efficiencies in the energy sector. So in addition to that, we're going to have to get a technology strategy together. You know, every Secretary of Energy puts out a technology strategy which consists of a list of what they're doing, right? But we're going to have to move to another level here. I mean, we're going to have a serious public-private engaged strategy here and eventually begin to think about looking at roadmaps. And it's going to have to be largely private sector-led in all the major technology pathways. So these are some pieces we're going to need, I think, on the back end. You know, the system that the Department of Defense built in the course of the Cold War to do IT is something that it's analogous here. DOD did the IT revolution by playing at every stage of the innovation system, you know. There may have been a lot of garages in Silicon Valley, but there was an enormous amount of Defense Department support as the IT revolution emerged. And DOD funded a lot of the research, it funded a lot of the development, it funded a lot of the demonstration, it funded a lot of the test beds, and it provided procurement to create a lot of the initial markets and many, many IT breakthroughs. And energy transformation, let's face it, is at least as hard as an IT revolution. And we're going to have to start thinking about this in a more systemic kind of way. And we've got a problem on the hillside, too. We're still writing bills backwards, right? Each technology has its own title, its own funding stream. There are many disconnected innovation strands in the way in which we've written energy technology in the last decade or so. And, you know, the more effective your public voice is for your energy, the bigger winner you are in an energy bill. We're going to have to change this. We've got to avoid technology lock-in. This is a 40-year problem we've got to deal with. This is not one of your three-year technology stand-up issues. you know, this is not getting to the moon in 8 years like the Apollo project. This is a 40-year problem, right? This is probably the toughest technology. It's not the hardest technology problem we've ever faced, right? We're starting to see a lot of technology opportunities. This is, however, the toughest technology implementation problem that we have ever had. And we're going to have to think differently about how we structure our legislation to allow, you know, something resembling, it'll never be perfect, but something resembling a more level playing field so that the better technologies can win out. And look at it as a 40-year kind of problem. You know, technology revolutions cost money. Where is the R&D money going to come from? And where's the implementation money going to come from? You know, we've got some real issues here on the funding stream. So we had major stimulus investment, right, close to $40 billion for DOE, $39 billion, $5.5 billion of which was for R&D, most of which was kind of later stage implementation. Huge new, you know, input of funds. That's 1 year money, right? We're headed up a ramp here. And what's the replacement piece? Well, the president had called for a clean energy technology fund as part of, you know, climate energy legislation. That's nowhere to be seen, right? And we're in a, you know, a fiscal mess, as usual. Where is that funding stream going to come from to undertake this? And that's a major challenge on the technology side of this revolution. Now, energy could be, as we've heard many references to today, it could be a new innovation wave in the economy. And that is, we now know, growth economists tell us, that's how economies grow, right? You know, anywhere from 50 to two-thirds of economic growth comes by introducing these big 30, 40-year-long innovation waves in your economy, right? And you have to begin to think about energy not only as kind of, you know, bad, unpleasant news. We've heard today that there may be an economic upside here. And could you get a new technology innovation wave to help drive this process, right? Because then you'd have a situation where the public investment starts driving and leveraging private sector investment side. So if you could start this wave, right, if you get this thing moved, then the dynamics of doing the revolution and the cost problem start to take care of themselves. The difficulty here is that an energy technology revolution, you know, we're still going to have cars, right? We're still going to, you know, plug in appliances to electric outlets. In the at least the initial stages of this technology revolution, you will not see visibly that much new functionality, right? Now, nobody in the United States minds paying for, you know, a wild new technology advance, you know, whether it's, you know, an iPod or an iPad or an iPhone, right? We don't mind throwing money at those problems because we get a whole new burst of functionality, right? There's a real key here in this energy revolution. How are we going to create visible new functionality that's going to drive that willingness to break those early price points? And that's a deep problem here, because I worry that there's not that much new functionality in the early stages of what we're going to get out of this. But there is a profound competitiveness challenge that's shaping up globally. The president has said that we can cede the race for the 21st century, or we can embrace the reality that our competitors already have. The nation that leads the world in creating a new clean energy economy will be the nation that leads the 21st century global economy. You know, interesting point. The United States has led every major innovation wave since we came up with interchangeable machine-made parts in the 1840s, funded, by the way, by the War Department. And we've led every other big one since, right? And to the profound benefit of this economy and eventually over time to the world economy. We may not win this one, right? We may not lead this one. This one is really hanging, right? And it would be the first time since 1840 that we haven't, right? And there are economic consequences for not leading innovation waves, right? When Japan did not lead the IT wave or the biotech wave, think what happened to their economy, right? And we did, and think what happened to ours in that same time period, right? This is a big stakes game here. And there's been two major reports in the last 6 months that kind of that indicate where the real investment in energy technology advances are being made. So let's go to some strategies that the administration needs to think about in this territory. We're going to need an energy innovation system strategy, okay? Not only a technology strategy. We're going to need a system strategy. Brings in the private sector, treats innovation as a system. It ties in the front end with the back end, with the innovation elements that we're going to need in both. We're going to need a roadmap, right, over time, right? We're not ready for this now. Let's see if we could just do a strategy, because a roadmap is radically more complicated. Let's see if we could do a strategy and then maybe get to a roadmap over time here. But we really need a strategy on energy technology. We're going to need an energy technology manufacturing strategy, too, because that's the way we're going to drive some of these prices down for these new entrant technologies. And then we're going to need an innovation funding strategy, a long-term funding strategy, because at the moment, short-term, it's a very unpleasant cliff that we're looking at here when the stimulus money runs out. Thank you.
So much. These are very fantastic presentations. Now, I'd like to invite people in the audience to ask questions. Just a friendly reminder on the ground rules, please state your name, affiliation, and ask your question in the form of a question. Yes, please. Oh, I'm sorry. And wait, please wait for the microphone. It's, I'm sorry. Oh, Rachel, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Nissim Rubin. I'm the American Jewish Committee's Program Director on Indian Jewish American Relations. And recently, I'm an Indian Jew. I took a mission of Indian American high tech leaders to Israel. And Project Better Place, what we saw, was one of the big stops that we made. I have a suggestion, Mike. In order to market this to developing countries, when I asked my ambassador in Tel Aviv whether he had been there, and he had not been there, what we need to do is ensure that more and more delegations from developing countries are brought to Project Better Place, because there's a phenomenal opportunity. You know, gas is still cheaper in America, but we pay through our nose in India. It costs 62 rupees a liter, which is more than what you pay here. And you know, so can you comment on that?
Thank you very much. That's great to hear. We've actually had about 30 foreign delegations through it. We've only been open 3 months with the visitor center. We've had about 30 foreign delegations, including from countries like Panama and Colombia, and I don't know all of them, but it's just a couple that I've heard about. But we're going to continue to make an effort to invite delegations from all types of countries to come see what we're doing in Israel. And the whole idea is that it is replicable, it's scalable, and it can work really just about anywhere. So, thank you.
Hi, Galia Benarzi. I'm an energy policy student over at SAIS, and I have another question for Project Better Place. It seems like your model is a great fit for small countries like Israel or Denmark, where you can kind of blanket the infrastructure that you're putting in place. What are some of the challenges you think you'll face trying to apply it to a larger country like in America or China, and what are your solutions?
That's a great question. First of all, for the record, we did a great job branding Project Better Place in our first 3 months of existence. The last 2 years, we've just been Better Place. But it's a really terrific question. And in fact, the third country we're doing it is Australia. And there were a lot of reasons to want to go to Australia, but one was to get away from the notion that this was simply for small countries. The fact of the matter is that the U.S. would be, if you had a level playing field in terms of the price of the incumbent technology, gasoline, it would be the most attractive market. We use 25% of the oil in the U.S. That's what we're going after. Obviously, a huge consumer market. People love to drive, lots of miles. And how would you go about doing it? Basically the same way the cell phone industry. They took the 40 biggest metropolitan areas, went from inside the city out, and then connected the corridors, put towers along the freeways. We'd put battery switch between the cities along the freeways and expressways, and you could get really very rapidly to the vast majority of the driving public and do it for a lot less than a year's worth of oil in terms of total infrastructure cost. The challenge is this, and I kind of had this Pollyannish notion a couple of years ago that, it's not as competitive in the U.S. because of cheaper gas, but everybody will want to do the U.S., so it'll happen anyway. But the challenge is this. You go to like HSBC, as we did, raise $125 million. They have a fiduciary obligation, a legal duty to their investors to get the highest return. So they can't just say, well, it would be really fun to do the West Coast. We have to go where people are paying today 30, 40 cents a mile driving instead of 13 or 14 cents. That's the challenge that we have to and frankly, we're a California-based company, right, neighbors with Bloom in Silicon Valley, but R&D is in Israel, and one of the most telling things is that our CEO, who had been based in California, hasn't set foot in the U.S. in the last 6 months. He's been basing out of Israel overseeing the R&D, and he's been going to Europe and to China, because China is, and this is consistent exactly with what we've heard from the other presenters. China has made the strategic decision at the highest levels of government that they want to lead in electric cars. Is it because they're very concerned about the carbon situation? I don't think so. I think it's, first of all, they're concerned about developing the same dependence on petroleum that we have here in the U.S. Second of all, they definitely care about the pollution in their cities. And when you take the tailpipes away, you take away that inner city smog. And third of all, I think they look at what we did in the last century, in the 20th century, with the automobile industry. We scaled this enormous industry, created all these jobs, made a mobile population, and built this amazing product that we could sell all over the world. And they're saying kind of hit the restart button now, and they've never been good at cars, but like I said, electric car, it's a big consumer electronic device. They know how to do that. And they know how to do batteries. So we're seeing either countries like Israel and Denmark that have incumbent tax policies that make them attractive for private investment, or we're seeing countries like China, France, and just last week Germany, who are orienting policy very directly to ride this wave. The U.S., unfortunately, right now, in neither of those camps, exactly what Bill was saying a moment ago, and that's the challenge that we all have to figure out. I'll go real quick. Better Place is committed to buying renewable and zero-carbon electrons wherever we can find them. In the early years, we might not be able to match one for one. But like I said, one of the things you do when you mass distribute electric cars across the grid is create storage, which changes the economics on the renewable electricity. So just as in Denmark, we're going to enable them to go from 20 to 30 or 40% wind electricity and putting the cars out there. Israel has tremendous solar technology. It's never really been economic to deploy it domestically in Israel, but there is now a push to do that from the government, from the private sector, and we think the addition of the cars, the batteries, the storage is going to make that move much faster. So that's the ultimate vision. But there still is an advantage to getting off of oil, specifically for a lot of countries, U.S. included, and the carbon profile of even given today's grid mix is lower for driving a mile on electricity based on today's grid than it would be on oil with millions of individual combustion engines and tailpipes, and that will get cleaner over time, like I said, with the help of those cars specifically.
In answer to your question regarding what is our strategy, given the fact that the demands for electricity generation are going to increase substantially, particularly in developing countries, and the answer is that we need to do it all. And it's a hard answer to understand, but if we're going to do it all, then our company wants to do clean coal. We've invested heavily, about $160 million over the last 5 years, on clean coal technologies, both post-combustion and combustion technologies. We're investing in nuclear. We have built a solar-powered generator for e-solar. That's a centralized boiler under the system. And so, from our company's standpoint, We want to put out the broadest range of technologies possible in order to meet the market conditions that we see that are developing out there. We're not going to focus on any one specific technology because, quite frankly, we see all of those technologies advancing.
Thank you. I'm Leonard Oberlander, independent consultant. I have a follow-up question for Craig Hansen and then a more broader question for Josh Richman. For Craig Hansen, what, in terms of keeping up with the technology, particularly abroad, what is the relative economic competitiveness of using nanotech, for example, cutting tools and coatings for parts to increase wear time in building nuclear power plants, as you had described earlier? And for Josh Richman, as for Bloom, as an American company, what are your thoughts on the significance or the impacts of these three factors? One, outsourcing, manufacturing outsourcing due to labor costs, overhead and taxes, and the availability of competent employees locally. Two, the hacking of data, information, and company secrets by other countries, but not by the U.S. the other way. And third, growth capital investment in other countries and corporations by U.S. investors. Thank you.
I'll go first. Obviously, in reactors and in all of our technologies, we use a wide variety of very specialized materials that wear very well in the very harsh environments that they're supposed to work in. We work with a lot of R&D companies in that, and if somebody has a nanotech technology that relates to the application of a coating, we would be certainly interested in listening and hearing that technology. But we have a very wide range of coating technologies, everything from annealing to actually a welded layer of cladding, whether it's stainless or Inconel, on our actual components.
I'll take the three in order. First, about outsourcing manufacturing. One thing that we found through economic analysis and just this decision of growth is you listed a few factors and you talked about skilled local labor, and that there's no shortage of that in the United States. A lot of our core manufacturing processes are borrowed from best practices of the auto industry and other domestic practices. So that's really not an issue. The hacking of data, it's an interesting question because the day after our 60 Minutes launch, there were 10,000 different attempts of external sources to crack into our CEO's email account. 10,000 that next day. It's a huge issue. It's a huge problem. I mean, we saw how Google responded. Implied in your question is should the U.S. start doing that instead? I'm not saying we should, but it is a real problem that others are doing that. Those 10,000 attempts were all, or the majority of, sourced from outside the United States. So it's a real problem. It's a real issue. Growth capital by U.S. investors. I think with new technologies, there's a perceived technology risk. And, I think access to capital exists. The question is at what terms? And you see places like the China Development Bank stepping in to essentially guarantee low-cost financing for that growth capital when there's an absence of private capital investment at the scale and the terms that are competitive. So it's a real issue, I think. As Bill mentioned, there are efforts for a green bank and other efforts to provide the access to capital at that really critical stage where companies are essentially in that valley of death where they've gone beyond the technology development and proving that technology to the point that they have to scale and be able to have the 10 years of data required to get the low-cost financing from private investors. So
It's a real issue, and it's, you know, one that I highlighted, and I think is one of the biggest challenges to technologies that go beyond the R&D stage to the proving stage, to the pilot stage, to get from pilot to high volume manufacturing.
John Chagas, Strategic Petroleum Consulting, formerly of Department of Energy. Mr. Bonvillian, the Department of Energy has a long history of front-end, back-end, and every place else integration of research, say, in the field of coal. And after 50 years of funding it, if you're not employed in the coal industry, you hate coal. Why should we have a very complicated, integrated system of R&D that involves tons of administrators and not just put a tax on carbon or imported carbon and let the companies like Babcock, Wilcox, Bloom, and Better Place figure out where to do their R&D?
As I discussed, John, there's obviously a major established energy sector. And it is very cost efficient, right? It's working off a set of mature technologies, right? And it's not facing a forced, disruptive moment anytime soon, at least in the U.S. economy, right? So it's very hard to drive innovation in that complex, very established sector, right? And there's a whole set of barriers, as we know, to driving innovation in that kind of established realm. And the history of technology transfer in the U.S. energy sector is not, there's lots of incremental advances, but it's not a disruptive history, frankly. We switch from wood to coal and then we added petroleum, but not a whole lot has happened in terms of fundamental shifts in a very long period of time. And we had, how many hundred millions of years worth of wood, right? I mean, these are slow glacial steps when we do a big energy shift in the planet. So if we're going to drive change, we're going to have new disruptive technologies introduced, frankly. And those are not likely to come out of the existing established sectors. They're going to have to arrive in a disruptive kind of way. And so you look at how you do those kinds of things, and you look at the analogies for those kinds of disruptive new entrant possibilities. You have to start thinking about putting together a system that's going to support a lot of those stages. So that's the kind of – that's the heart of my argument. I'm not in any way arguing that a price signal in the economy isn't important. I think it's crucial. Right, I think it's a very important driver, and as Craig was pointing out, they're waiting for that price signal for a whole raft of technologies they're working on the nuclear side. It's very interesting. These modular power plants are a very interesting technology story. So I don't know how we do this, frankly, without a pricing signal. But on the other hand, I do think that if we're going to arrive at the portfolio of new technologies that we're going to need, we're going to have to look at the history of how U.S. evolves these new technologies and the recent big innovation waves in this country have relied on a very substantial role, by the kind of federal R&D pipeline system in the process. But in addition, there were, follow-on stages by the federal government that made this a more systemic approach. And I think we're going to need that, in energy. I just don't see any way around it.
I'm Mitzi Wertheim. I created something called the Energy Conversation, and was able to get the line in the President's State of the Union, "The nation has a problem, we're addicted to oil." Energy was a forbidden topic at the Department of Energy until we got that line in the State of the Union. Leadership matters a lot, because the Vice President was really against anybody else playing in the energy game, and the Navy, where I spent 4 years as a deputy undersecretary, wasn't even the tip of the tail on the dog. It wasn't even on the dog until the Navy got its new secretary, Secretary Mabus, and they've really leaped forward understanding the role that DOD can play. First of all, are we going to be able to have access to these slides? Okay. Secondly, I want to ask our representative from MIT, because I happen to think systems thinking really matters. And one of the things, I'm a social anthropologist by training. When I got into the energy game, I started with a salon at my house, and we had an age gap of 45 years, and it was interdisciplinary, and we were open to everybody who was players that was interested to coming and learning and sharing, and it was a self-learning group. The interdisciplinary part is so important, and I don't see that as a part of a lot of college education. And I guess my question is, does MIT build systems thinking into the broad spectrum? Is it only on the technical side?
So, you know, one of the fascinating things about being at MIT at the moment, Mitzi, is that the largest student activity in the history of the school, and we're approaching 150 years, has occurred in the last 4 years, right? And we have an energy and a student body of 10,000. We have an energy club that now has 1,600 members, right? It is so much more powerful than any other student activity in the history of the school. And this organization essentially came together because of a very deep concern, particularly amongst graduate students, of exactly this stovepipe problem, right? That they were studying materials, they were studying chemistry and so forth, but they realized that they wanted to play in this energy space, and you couldn't do it just by one discipline at a time, right? So they actually came together to put together a program to teach each other about what was going on, right? So, you know, as I've learned at MIT over the years, if you actually want something to happen at MIT, the students have to drive it, right? That's actually how change comes about there. Faculty think they run the place, but in the end, the students are the great drivers of change, and they've done it periodically in the school's history. And this is maybe the biggest that they've driven. But as a result, we have now had to create an energy curriculum at MIT in a very systematic and organized, wonderful, disciplined, tough-minded MIT way, very, very deeply interdisciplinary. And, you know, the students essentially thought the need of that up. MIT changes its curriculum after, you know, the faculty equivalent of, you know, medieval wars, right? I mean, it does not change, right? God forbid you had lost a single credit hour off the biology major requirement or whatever it is. These don't change very often, right? So when the faculty worked with students in designing this new curriculum, which includes the social sciences and economics, it includes, you know, architecture, it includes planning, and it includes a whole raft of new courses coming about in science and engineering space, including systems. When they introduced that proposal, it was brought to the fact that everybody is terrified always of bringing a curriculum change to the faculty. It was approved in 1 hour by a unanimous vote. Okay, so we are seeing the evolution of an energy curriculum. And, you know, as our president likes to say, it's very important to know that deep disciplinary dive, right, to really understand disciplinary areas well. But you've got to have T people, right? They've got to have an understanding of the other pieces that are going to come to bear, particularly in a complex area like energy. And we're really trying to work to create that curriculum. DOE, and I was on one of my slides, I didn't mention it, but DOE gets this, right? They know that revolutions have a strong foundation in knowledge and talent, right? And if you want to spread a revolution, you've got to create the knowledge base to do so. So one of the secretary's interesting proposals, you know, has been this re-energized energy education curriculum that could well help force, you know, a new kind of approach, a new kind of interdisciplinary way of looking at an energy to give us the talent base that we're going to need that can think across these various disciplinary sectors.
If I could just pick up on that for one moment, because this issue of interdisciplinary, I think, is critical. You know, one of the problems I've run into here in Washington is talk about electric cars, and everyone says, oh, yeah, they're definitely for electric cars. That's why, you know, it's one of DOE's top priorities with all the other things that DOE also has to do as top priorities. But I look at this actually as fundamentally it's near-term job creation program. Secondly, you know, we went through an entire restructuring of the automobile industry without having a conversation about what is the car for the 21st century and why is the answer to downsize Detroit when the global car park is doubling in the next 20 years from 700 million to 1.5 billion cars. In addition to that, you know, half of our trade deficit is a result of importing oil. So I view electrification transportation as much, much greater than just an energy policy issue. And as long as it's treated just as a line item in the DOE budget, if that's the extent of it, we're not going to be able to compete with what China's doing and other countries are doing. And that's why, you know, I think it does need an interdisciplinary top-down leadership.
Will Cole from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Just one quick question for Craig Henson. I'm very interested in the prospects for smaller-sized modular nuclear reactors, and I wondered if you could say a little more about the markets you're targeting for this. Is it mainly smaller countries around the world that are getting more interested in nuclear power, or do you think that these are going to appeal to the U.S. market as well, and could you explain a little more?
Yeah, I mean, we think that it's, the first market we're going to target is here in the United States. And we'll target either smaller utilities that can afford a larger unit, or we'll target for replacement of older coal fire plants that are reaching the end of their life, or we'll target where if there's ever a cap and trade system or some type of value placed on carbon, where a utility wants to bring in an incremental amount of clean or carbon-free electricity. So there's a large number of markets. Now, that's the first part, but in the long term, we see a very substantial market for this size of reactor, especially in developing countries where their transmission and grid system is not as well developed as in the United States. So ultimately, we believe there's also a very robust market internationally, and we've been over to India on a regular basis and throughout the world discussing that possibility.
I do have a little bit of a sort of add-on question. So where are you at in terms of working with NRC? I realize that you're one of the two technologies or designs that they're reviewing. I'd imagine there are lots of sort of first-of-kind challenges. If you could just sort of briefly highlight some of the challenges.
We have been very pleased with our interactions with the NRC. We are in the process of submitting topical papers. We will submit our DCA, our design certification application, in probably about 2 years from now, roughly 2 years from now. And all of that should allow us to move forward with a first plant in around the 2020 timeframe. Now, again, you talk about first-of-a-kind technologies, and this is a first-of-a-kind application, but what we have really done is taken existing technologies and use them in different ways that will make the NRC very comfortable, because one of our key strategies is to minimize the licensing effort that is required by NRC so that we can bring this to market very quickly.
Justin Manger with Sojus Corporation. A couple quick questions for Josh Richmond. I was wondering, I think it was eBay that had the Bloom Box out there. I was wondering if you have any installations or test sites up at homes, consumers, and kind of related, what is the maintenance on these units? Do you need to replace the fuel cell every once in a while? And if you do, is that difficult? Do you need a professional, or can it be done, in-house? And then real quick for Michael, I was wondering if there's any feedback yet on the Tokyo taxicab. And either from the government or from the taxi drivers themselves?
The residential unit is not something we've commercialized yet. It's not a technological challenge. It's more of a market decision. The key to success is affordability. And, there are some people out there who will pay more for a clean solution, but that's – our model isn't predicated on that. Our model is to be cost competitive and provide real savings. So to do that, we are basically following the Henry Ford model of we'll give you anything you want as long as it's black. And we have the 100 kilowatt building block systems that we're mass producing right now. And that's what we're selling in multiples to mainly commercial industrial customers right now. We will be introducing a residential product, but it does introduce service challenges. It's much easier and better to service a few systems in a few places rather than many systems, in multiple places. So it's just a business decision, not a technical decision. The maintenance is simple. It's replacing some filters every now and then, and there is a natural degradation that occurs on the cell, and occasionally the cells do need to be popped out. But our business model is that we as Bloom take the cost to do that, and we provide all the service. We talked about the need to be affordable, reliable, clean, and easy. And if our business success was predicated upon all of our customers learning how to operate and maintain these systems, we wouldn't get very far. So we remote monitor the systems 24/7, and when we see a dip in performance, we send our people out and we do a quick hot swap of the module that needs to be replaced while the rest of the system continues to operate. And as the user, there's really no noticeable difference.
On the Tokyo program, I should have mentioned, this actually was at the invitation of the Japanese government. They paid for this program. They wanted to see if what we claimed was the case, because taxi cabs in Tokyo are 2% of the cars and 20% of the emissions. So you can't really plug a cab in. These are cabs that operate around the clock. You know, so no cab driver is going to take time off to charge his cab. You have to be able to do it much, much quicker. So the switches have taken on average about 59 seconds from go in and switch the battery, come out. We're in the third week of the program. The government's paid for 3 months, and then we'll see what happens from there. But so far, reviews from cab drivers, from observers, government, passengers, all been very, very positive.
My name is Yong Soo Hang. I'm working as a visiting fellow in CSIS, and I'm actually from South Korea, National Laboratory for the Nuclear Energy. I have a couple of questions, one for the small modular type reactors, and the other one is so-called E-mile, using the so-called switchable battery for the car. Actually, we are doing the similar thing to develop the small modular type reactor in Korea. And quite frankly, the cost is a little bit higher. I should say much higher than the ordinary PWRs. And you are saying that you have some vision to introduce that one in the United States. And according to our calculation, it's a little bit different. As you mentioned, it might be valuable to deploy that kind of reactor in underdeveloped country whose grid system is not so good, or you have to have additional purpose to implement that one. Otherwise, the economy is one problem. And there is another problem about non-proliferation issues. Of course, yeah, you mentioned that your refueling time is around more than 48 months. That means you should have a higher enrichment for the uranium, for the fresh fuel. And we are wondering that it might create some kind of international issue for the nuclear proliferation. So if you have any comment about economy and the non-proliferation, please let me know. I'm not good at the E-mile project. I'm just a layman, but I had a lot of chance to discuss that matter with my colleagues in South Korea. And we are trying to introduce that system very soon in capital city of South Korea, Seoul. And we see a lot of not technical problem, but legal problem to really implement that kind of option. For example, what if there is a malfunctioning battery during the car operation? Who is responsible about that one? And what if there is a car accident during the operation of that car? What's the liability of the government when you introduce that kind of system? And unless you have very clear legal system against those kind of legal disputes, it might be very, very difficult to commercialize so-called switchable battery operated car commercially. So if you have any good idea to solve that kind of non-technical but legal issues, please let me know. Thank you.
I'll start out. Obviously, the cost challenges are great on building a smaller reactor, but there are certain advantages that come into play. And we have some of them I went over in the presentation, a centralized manufacturing of the unit, heavy use of modular manufacturing, get the work out of the field. For every hour that I move out of the field and into the centralized manufacturing plant, I can reduce the hours consumed by almost 1 to 8 to 1 to 5. or five to one or 8 to 1. So a significant reduction in the amount of time that it's necessary to do that. We will have to work with regulators to establish the right regulations and oversights that will allow us to do a lot of the system testings back at the centralized plant, vice out in the field, which will save us tremendously. It will also allow us not to have to transport components back and forth or take them out of the finished system to go off and recalibrate them or fix them. We look at the overall life cycle cost of the process, whether it is transmission lines or the time value of money. And when you begin putting all of those, you know, as we've talked about here today, this is a very, very complex industry. And when you begin putting all of those equations together, and some of this is proprietary, so we don't talk about it too broadly, but when you put all of those things together, then we believe that we can be very, very competitive in this industry. As far as nuclear nonproliferation, we use standard PWR, low-enriched uranium, and so we're the same as every other reactor vendor out there.
I'm not sure I fully understood the question, but I think it pertained to legal issues surrounding a battery switch model. They are having to create a kind of category in Israel to license us to operate, but there's not too much resistance around that. And, the issue comes up a lot of, what's the competition going to be? Right now we've got our hands full competing against the 100% market share incumbent of gasoline. In time, there'll be other operators that will come, and there will be interoperability. There's standards around the plugs. There are going to be standards in other areas as well, and it'll be just like in the cell phone industry where you don't necessarily know which provider's providing your service at that moment, but you have a contract with one, and that's how it works. I just want to apologize for anybody who wants to run up and ask me a question afterwards, because I've got to hop right onto a call, but I'll just say my email address for people who may want to follow up with anything, which is mike.granoff@betterplace.com. Thanks.
Daniel Saracino from the Center for New American Security. I was wondering how you thought the energy revolution would go, considering that a lot of these new technologies require critical minerals that the United States doesn't have access to. Molly Corp said in a congressional hearing that they could get it, both some of them, but they're not, and it's only some, not all. China currently has about conservatively 93% of the global rare earth market. And that's the most conservative estimate. And that Beijing's also announced that they're going to be cutting back how much they're exporting, because they're doing their own revolution and they want to have their own, and they don't even have enough to sustain themselves. So how will the American revolution, as far as energy goes, and also with the nod to DOD, which through the QDR and then yet last week's Military Energy Security Act that got introduced, how are they going to deal with implementing this revolution if we don't have the things to do it, because the electric cars, the batteries that are new technology, a three megawatt windmill requires 1 ton of one critical mineral alone. How's this really going to work? Is it going to affect our foreign relations? Is it going to affect our own security? Mr. Hansen spoke about the security of the supply chain, but that's really not the case right now. So, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
You know, the rare earth mineral problem is a real problem, right? And I don't think there's any getting around that. And, you know, obviously, therefore, there's going to be a premium on technologies that that are able to get around some of that. That's obviously a huge cost issue for new entrant technologies, as we well understand, and therefore it puts a premium not only for cost but supply on solutions to work around those. So, you know, I mean, DARPA, for example, is looking at the whole problem of titanium supply, right? So DARPA is looking at, is there a really low... Titanium is actually pretty available. It's just not available at the kind of scale we need it at, right? And, you know, they've got a whole project trying to figure out if we could take this comparatively highly available metal that's available only in tiny quantities and make that workable. We may have to do some work in that territory and other areas as well. But, you know, there's no simple answer on this, and this is a revolution buster, at least in the cases of some emerging technology, so you got to work your way around it, right? Platinum, for example, has been a deep problem in fuel cells for a long time, and there's a lot of effort going on which I'm sure Josh can tell us about, to get around that in some particular technology areas. So it's a problem that we know about and we can recognize and see in advance, and that's got to affect the kind of projects, for example, that RPD would move to stand up. Now, remind me of your second question, just for a second. Yeah. Well, I think that's the same answer. I think. But there are people here that are dig into these technologies, so let me turn it over to some of them. Josh, you got something on this?
Craig? I'll just answer on the supply chain. Clearly, the supply of rare earth minerals is something that we go off and look at. It's really a game of a supply and demand. If the demand increases above what the supply is, or if the supply is controlled, then the price goes up, and then alternative technologies come on board. So it's a question of supply and demand and how quickly we can implement alternative technologies and secure additional sources of those materials.
Yeah, the reliance on precious metals like platinum has been something that has limited the fuel cell sector and will continue to. If demand ever increases for those fuel cell technologies that rely on platinum ever increases, the price of platinum is going to go up. That's why Bloom, our technology is based on a beach sand, a zirconia-based sand. It's widely available on four continents, and our biggest competitor is fake costume jewelry, the cubic zirconia jewelry. So it's not really an issue for us, and that's one of the reasons we've designed the solution we have, and we have the clear path towards cost reduction that we have. The key is having multiple suppliers of that sand and all the components we have, and that is a global supply chain issue that we have to continue to work through. But our solution is very unique in multiple ways, and one of those is the low cost materials that we build our product out of, and we don't use platinum. We don't use other precious metals.
I think there'll be technological solutions to a lot of these issues. I'd also remind people in the 1880s, I think it was, there was a report issued that said most of the world's known oil reserves are probably in northeast Pennsylvania. So, as markets develop, tend to find other sources of resources.
Well, thank you so much for sticking around to the very end, and please join me in giving another round of applause to our fantastic panel. Thank you so much.